Socrates, the only true wisdom consists in knowing that you know nothing.
That's us, dude.
Oh, yeah.
Sun comes up and rises high. It's so hot, it's gonna make me cry. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
Welcome to episode number 7 of the Modern Masculinity Project. If you haven't listened to the show, my name is Brad Pinky. I am the host of these conversations where I sit down with other men to have open and vulnerable discussions around different issues such as masculinity and gender topics and whatever the hell else we want to talk about. If you have heard the show, hi. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for tuning in. I release these conversations every Monday, but you can subscribe to the show so you never miss one in case I take a break or get hit by a car for a third time or something like that. And thank you to those of you who have rated and reviewed the podcast on various platforms. Appreciate you and would encourage and love if everyone else could do the same. As always, ladies, you can submit questions for What Women Wonder via email, mmprojectpod@gmail.com, and get at me on the Twitter machine at mmprojectpod is the handle. Guys, also, please don't hesitate to reach out if you have something you'd like to share, any stories, or if you're even in the Portland area and you'd like to join me for a conversation on the podcast, go ahead and reach out to that email address on Twitter. It can be had there. We're going commando today, folks. No notes for the intro, none of that. It's just me, this microphone, and my mistakes. And, you know, it kind of feels good just to riff a little bit to, you know, it feels a little bit thrilling to be out there flapping in the digital breeze, unrestricted. It's nice to challenge the brain every so often, right? Challenge the way we think a little bit, keep an open mind. I think we could all do a little better in that area. And I think challenging yourself, you know, pushing beyond what you think is possible is a great way to learn. And that brings me to my guest today, Dr. Jeff Armstrong, Dr. A, as I used to call him. But I think Jeff, have I graduated to Jeff now? I think so. I don't know. Dr. A, Jeff, I apologize, but we're going with Jeff. Jeff was my physiology professor at Western Oregon University. Only had one or two classes with him. We talked about it, but couldn't quite remember. But what stood out to me the most was just his passion for teaching and for the subject material. I just deeply appreciate educators like this because they're always the ones who get people excited about learning. I know those types of educators got me really excited just about learning and about the process. And these are the people who have helped me find my passion along the way. And they're also the people who challenged my way of thinking the most along the way. And I'm so grateful to run into people like this, like Jeff. And that's why I wanted to have him in for a conversation. I knew that he would have a different take on everything, just, you know, coming from a different generation and just having just a different geographical area. And I'm just really grateful that we were able to connect. And I hope you all enjoy our talk. Before we get to it, I just want to let y'all know that I will be sharing some thoughts and feelings about several happenings from this last week. To check in with everyone and just share what's on my mind a bit. Stick around if you'd like to hear that. If not, that's cool too. Just enjoy this episode that I've got for you here. All right. Here it is, episode number 7 of the Modern Masculinity Project, Baby Stepping Forward with Dr. Jeff Armstrong.
I rush fast like the rapid river, a rough and heavy steady flow. The rocks stop me for a moment, but I weave above and bend below. I eat what is fed me, I can cause a deadly blow. And still the river flows, only heaven knows where the two winds flow, where the rivers flow.
Yeah, so you can see where that's a lot better, right?
Yeah.
Cool. So you got finals next week?
Yes, I do.
How is that? So I haven't seen you in like...
Yeah, I was trying to think, when did you graduate?
2009.
I was actually thinking it was longer than that, but...
No, that was it. Yeah, so that's the last time I've seen you.
Yeah.
How's it comparing from then now? How a lot of things changed?
Not really.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I think my teaching has probably changed. I know when you were a student there, you were in that stadium classroom, right? That little dungeon underneath the stands.
Yeah. It's like an old weight
room.
Yeah,
we have a new lab now and things like that.
Yeah, because I think that was just that whole like fitness thing just got approved to be built or something when I was there.
I'm trying to think how long we've been in there.
But I was never there.
No. It's nice, and that's where I have my office hours and do all that kind of stuff. But
a little more comfortable then?
Yeah, a lot more comfortable. Yeah. It's a lot easier to teach, too. Yeah. I don't have to go next door and yell at anybody for the bass being too loud.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Hey, guys, can you turn that down?
I'm not sure if you've been in any of the classes where I went in and just got friction from people.
No.
There was one time I went over... And one of the coaches was in there, and he's like, couldn't believe that it was that loud. And I said, well, why would I come over if it's not that loud? And he wanted to come over and check, the sound. And it was the first time I ever dropped an F-bomb in class. I was like, what the fuck? And then there was another time I went over, and this football player starts giving me lip. And it wasn't even a big guy. He was smaller than me.
Yeah.
And I seriously?
Yeah, you're like, come on, man.
And I get back in the classroom and he cranks the stereo back up. And I'm like...
That's just an open act of defiance right there.
Okay, great. I'm going to end up punching a student. Yeah, lose my job.
That's not good. No. Don't go there.
No, it all worked out.
Yeah. Even in the classroom, do you find that... Because it's still hard for me to believe like 10 years ago that I was there. But do you find that students are any different as far as their learning styles?
Not particularly. I think my teaching style has changed. I can't remember if I was using PowerPoint only when you took the class or not, but I shifted over to just using the whiteboard and trying to just teach more, kind of more freestyle based on the responses from the students. And it's worked so much better.
Yeah, I think you were using a little bit of PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Like exercise, motivation, adherence.
Yeah.
You had some PowerPoint.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But that was still pretty interactive. That was super discussion oriented.
Yeah.
That class was fun.
That class has changed a lot.
Really?
I've really just dropped a lot of the... I mean, there's only two PowerPoint presentations that I do.
Mm.
We watch What About Bob?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
I probably watched
that. Oh, yeah. I still remember that.
We watch Heavyweights.
Yeah.
You know, for childhood obesity. And then I've been having them watch the series My Diet's Better Than Yours.
Okay.
And we just evaluate how these trainers are interacting with their their clients and just the diets themselves and what to do, what not to do. And
that must be making you lose your hair. Looking at all these diets and different
training,
different training regimens out there.
So, but it's been great because I deal a lot more with kind of just the emotions of training and interacting with people. And like the last lecture I do is kind of motivating yourself because I don't know if you knew, I had a business 4 years ago that we closed.
Oh, okay.
And, the stress that was involved with that and just having to get up every morning and motivate myself, not only for that, but to go down to Monmouth to teach.
Sure. It's a lot.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, for 10 years now, I've had the pleasure of teaching, but then the frustration of teaching.
Right.
You know, with being around an academic setting that doesn't want to change, doesn't see where our field could be so much better.
Yeah. Is that just the university system as a whole?
University, but division and stuff like that. It's kind of stuff I should not be saying on a podcast. I don't know if you're recording this now.
Yeah, we're going.
Okay, I figured we were live.
Yeah, just let me know. Yeah. Here's the thing. Like, I always appreciated about you so much is just how passionate you were about teaching.
Yeah.
Like, you seemed so excited about the subject. And that's just so important because I've had so many teachers and professors who just didn't give a shit. And it was like, why are you here?
Yeah.
Because I'm just so disengaged with the subject and everything. So I always appreciated that about you.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. it shows. And it makes a big difference for people. Especially, I think, undergrad who are like still kids, right?
Yeah.
Still kids trying to find their way, what they're passionate about. And when you see somebody else so passionate about something, it's really helpful.
I've probably gotten worse.
Yeah, getting a little get off my lawn attitude going on.
No, not really that. It's you know, just the things I see on the internet, and you know, I'll be on Facebook in the morning, and there'll be some ad for some fitness product something like that, and I'm just like, yeah. I just want to scream, and I go into class and just go off on tangents. And
well, there's something that's a little different from when I was in. At Western.
Yeah.
Facebook was a thing, but it wasn't like it is now.
Yeah.
Not everyone and their grandma was on there giving fitness advice and giving dating advice and giving political advice.
Yeah. Oh, the political advice is the worst.
Oh, it makes me want to light my face on fire. It's just horrible. All of it's horrible. All of it. Because there's no, it goes nowhere.
Yeah.
There's no discussions going on. They're just yelling at each other.
Yeah. And that's our society now. We just yell at each other. We don't converse. And that's why I love this.
Yeah, me too. That's... you know, it's actually nice to intentionally sit down with somebody and say, hey, we're going to talk. Like, what?
Yeah. I found, you know, it's interesting having moved 10 years ago to the Northwest from the Midwest and from being raised on the East. You know, you think that the East is so much more antisocial and just people putting you off. And honestly, I think the people that I have been closest to are people from New York.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about growing up out there.
Yeah.
Because you're from...
I grew up in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
I lived in New York. I went to college at WVU and I'm actually sporting my WVU shirt and did my PhD at Toledo.
Okay.
So everything kind of in that Midwest. Yeah. But, you know, I've lived New York, Pittsburgh, Morgantown, Toledo, Ohio.
Yeah.
Did a little stint in Texas. So I've been a little bit all over.
Yeah.
But it's very different moving here.
Very different.
People will tell you what they mean, you know, what they're thinking, what they mean on the East Coast. And, you know, they may sound harsh if you're not prepared for it, but they're just speaking their mind.
I like
it. And they allow you to speak your mind.
Yeah.
You know, and you might argue back and forth, but, you know, some of my best arguments or discussions with people have ended in a beer. You know?
Sure.
It's just like, hey, let's be buddies.
I know.
Here, you try and speak your mind, people take it personally.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. You just got to be open and be willing to talk.
I don't want
to
hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
I don't want to hurt your feelings.
Yeah, we call it Northwest nice.
Yeah. Yeah, super passive aggressive, too. Yeah. It's funny, though, like if you kind of stay bottled up like that and don't just speak your mind because you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings, then you never actually say what you feel or mean.
Right.
And it goes nowhere. And then you just amplify that by being on social media, hiding behind a keyboard.
Yep.
And then you're just yelling at people.
Alerts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Twitter, where you, what is it, 140 characters?
No, I think it's 280 now.
Oh, 280.
Oh, yeah. They've really
do Twitter.
They've really opened it up on Twitter.
I'm not a twit.
Twit. I like Twitter. Yeah. I like it for just like a news feed, pretty much.
Yeah.
Which is good and bad, but I try to look at both sides. But it's really easy just to follow if like. You were super into Fox News. All you could follow was like Fox News people.
Yeah.
So it's the only opinion you ever see. Yeah. So, which is, I don't know, but whatever you want to do. So growing up, what was growing up in Pittsburgh like? Having no contact. I mean, I grew up in Oregon.
Yeah.
So.
It was great. I mean, Pittsburgh is still one of my favorite cities.
Yeah.
And it's funny coming to Portland, the first time we came here to kind of tour around and look for homes and stuff. And we're driving through more of the city of Portland, and I was like, this looks familiar.
Oh, really?
And like this community here where you live, driving around here, it feels very familiar to me. And I realized, this is Pittsburgh.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like very much, you know, minus the snow in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And minus the snowplows when it does snow. But it's hilly, you know, you have kind of those close communities, and it's just that same feel.
Yeah. It's not the apocalypse in Pittsburgh when it snows like it is here.
No, absolutely not.
Everyone
freaks
out.
It doesn't stop anything. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was first working as a personal trainer in Pittsburgh and driving around, having to be on the job by 6 o'clock in the morning and driving to work in my little two-wheel drive Toyota Tercel in front of the snowplows.
Oh, my God.
And here, there's like no snowplows and nobody would even be out driving.
I remember being in Eugene and I think one of my professors told me, she was on like the city board or something, and they budget one day of snowplow. Which is means like they budget 0 days. It's just like they don't even bother. The whole city just shuts down. But so you're just, you grew up, how long were you in Pittsburgh?
Pretty much from birth. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, but we spent, I think, 3 months there and moved to Pittsburgh. So essentially, you know, I'm raised in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I was there until graduated from college, or until I went to college. And then, you know, 4 years away being in Morgantown, actually 5 years with my master's. And then I moved back for probably, I think it was about 2-3 years. Moved to New York for a couple of years, then went out to Texas for 2 years. Back to Pittsburgh for, I think it was like another year or two. And then I decided I was going to get my PhD. So I went back to New York to work to make some money and then went to Toledo.
Okay.
So I was in Pittsburgh probably, you know, at least 25 years total. Yeah.
All right.
So all right. Most of my life.
Yeah.
It's, well, actually not most of my life anymore. But
no, not. No.
Yeah.
Oof.
It's kind of funny. I just realized recently that the house we're in Portland here is the longest I've ever lived in a single dwelling in my life.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So we've been there about 9 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's kind of a cool, really. That's home.
Yeah. It's home now.
So. That's cool. That's cool. So, and I'm assuming sports growing up then.
Yeah. I think I had a really interesting childhood with sports. I mean, did little league football, tried baseball. I was horrible at baseball.
Yeah.
My dad still laughs about how I'd be out in the outfield and I'd be standing with my mitt up in the air,
waiting for the ball,
and it would land like 10 feet behind me. I was horrible. Could never hit a ball. So I think I did maybe a few years of Little League baseball. I did some track. My sisters, they had a women's girls community track club and eventually opened it up to men. And so I did a little bit of that for a couple years. I did track through high school up until my senior year. So basically just football, wrestling, and track were my primary sports.
Nice.
Just loved it. Wrestling, I think, looking back, I wish I had invested a little bit more in it.
Just more time and energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was strange for a wrestler my size back then, because I played football about 215. The weight class options weren't for me were 185 or unlimited. I mean, they weren't even heavyweight, where you could wrestle somebody could be 500 pounds. Not that you ever did, but so
you were in a tough zone.
Yeah.
Then.
So I'd have to usually lose to go down. We had my junior and senior year, we had a pretty decent heavyweight. It was a year behind me. A good friend of mine, Ken, that we were pretty comparable. And my senior year, I had decided I wasn't going to go down. I was tired of losing weight. I lose 30 pounds every year. And it was just like, why am I doing this? I want to wrestle heavyweight. And you know, in hindsight, it was one of the most selfish things I've ever done in my life. But at the time, you know, I was going through issues with my mom, and I was just came out of a kind of a crappy season of football.
Yeah.
I had a pinched nerve in my neck going into the wrestling season, and so I couldn't beat Ken in initial wrestle-offs. And so in order to get the varsity spot, I had to beat him twice in a row.
Yeah.
And I'd win one, he'd win one. You know, it was back and forth. And finally, about a third of the way into the season or so, the kid that was wrestling 185, Rich Bonacorsi, he was really good wrestler. He went on to be an All-American in college. The year before, wrestled 165, and it was a pretty natural weight for him. But he was kind of the same boat where he'd have to lose a bit. He ends up getting sick with the flu and had lost a bunch of weight and would have easily made weight at 165, but was going to miss a match.
Oh.
And I come into practice at 205. And I normally would lose about 9 pounds in practice, just sweating.
Jesus.
And so I come out of practice, I had 8 more pounds to lose. And I told the coach, I said, okay, I'll cut the weight. I'll make weight for tomorrow. And so I lost the additional 8 pounds. I went out that whole evening with a buddy of mine. He hit his dad's old Jeep Wagoneer, and I bundled up in plastics and parka. And you know, I'd run for a while, then get into the vehicle, and he'd drive for a little bit with the heat on. And I'm just sweating. Got up in the morning, went to school, basically went to all my teachers. It's like, can I get out and I need to cut weight? Can I go run? And they pretty much all let me out.
It
would never happen anymore. I got out of pretty much all my classes. I'd go up in the pool deck with plastics on and just run and sweat. And I had a trigonometry test last period that day. And so I'd stop, I'd study a little bit, and then I'd run some more. And you know, I just kind of got out of all those classes, didn't eat lunch, sweated all day, went into that test at my last period, still wearing plastic, still sweating, and I look at the test and it just looked like it was all Greek to me.
I was going to say, could you even see straight at
that point? I couldn't at that point. And so I hand the test back to the teacher. I said, can I go run? She's like, sure. So I go and run, and I went and made weight,
yeah,
and which was, in hindsight, the stupidest thing I've ever done. Because 17 pounds in 24 hours.
Physically dangerous.
Yeah, it's on the borderline of killing myself.
Yeah, yeah.
But amazingly, I went out and I wrestled probably one of the best matches I've ever wrestled against this guy. It was a guy who had pinned me, I think, at least two or three times before, a really good wrestler. And I don't know, maybe he knew the circumstances of what I had done and took it easy on me, but you know, nobody does that.
No.
And if he wanted to take it easy on me, he would have just pinned me right away.
Sure.
So I ended up losing to him. I think it was like 5-2 or something like that. And I went on points and wrestled a good match and stayed down the rest of the season. But you know, a number of years ago, I think it was about 3 years ago now, my coach, Dave Kling, passed away for, I forget what kind of cancer, but he died of cancer. Mm. Not suddenly, I think he was kind of suffering with it for a while, but it just got me, you know, when I heard of his death, it just kind of got me reflecting. And I thought back on that. I'm like, geez, I was an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't I just from the start take one for the team and drop down there? It was purely selfish on my part. Yeah. I wasn't doing my part for the team. And it was kind of a bit of an awakening for me.
Yeah. Did you connect with him pretty well, the coach?
Yeah. I mean, my wrestling coaches were awesome. All of my wrestling coaches throughout. In fact, I've lost two of the three that I had in high school. My freshman coach died. He had a heart condition that I think it was just inevitable that he was going to be out shoveling the snow someday and have a heart attack. And he died. And he was a beast of a guy. I remember freshman year, we had one guy on the team, one of the lighter weights, that me and the heavier guy would have to determine who was going to practice with them, and the other would end up practicing with Coach Conley.
Yeah.
And Coach Conley played college football. I mean, he was a big bear of a guy. And this guy that was our lighter wrestler never washed his workout gear. So, I mean,
God.
I mean, imagine the ripest of ripe wrestling gear and magnify that about five times.
And then your face is in it the whole time.
Oh, yeah, your face is in it the whole time. And we would just literally, like, have a wrestle off to see, you know, winner got to wrestle Conley.
Oh, God.
You'd think you'd want to wrestle someone other than the coach, but we would fight it out. And I'd usually win, so I usually got to wrestle Coach Conley. But, and then, you know, my sophomore year, I bumped up to varsity. And, you know, typically a sophomore doesn't wrestle varsity, especially in the upper weights. And so my coaches were, you know, are you ready for this? And
yeah.
I remember the first match, Dave Colley, the assistant coach, gave me a ride over to the middle school where the matches were going to be and just, you know, wanted to make sure that I was good with it all and everything else. And so they were great guys. I mean, they were very inspirational in terms of how I see coaching and interacting with people.
Well, not even that. When you're like, 14 to 18 years old, you latch on to those male figures in life.
Yeah.
Especially within the sports arena, if you're jacked up on sports.
Yeah.
You love sports. It's like you're looking for the leader, the pack leader. And it just kind of speaks, I think it speaks volumes how important like having good coaches are for young people.
Yeah.
I had some coaches where it was like father figures, you know, just love the guy, my high school basketball coach. Oh my God. But he was also our teacher and I was like his room aide. So I spent a lot of time with the guy, but just like the sweetest guy, you know, sports was like, he cared, but it was like, he cared about us as people more.
Yeah.
You just get some coaches who are super aggro and like, they might get you jacked up for sports, but then I don't know, outside of sports, it's not a great thing.
I haven't had too many of those. I mean, I've had coaches that weren't that great, but typically had some pretty good coaches.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Sports was, you know, it was a pretty much a part of life. It was, you know, and I think it was a balanced life. My dad never pushed me into sports, but always kind of encouraged me along the way. And it was always balanced. I mean, I told the story numerous times in classes and stuff about how when I was in, I think it was fifth grade, that Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh had an art scholarship that they gave two scholarships to each elementary school, I think, in the Pittsburgh area.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the two from my school that got a scholarship to go every Saturday morning for art lessons. And I'd go for my art lessons. My dad would drop me off, go in. I forget, it was probably 2 hours. He'd come back, pick me up. And familiar with Pittsburgh, I mean, it's all tunnels leading into the city. And from where I lived, we'd go through the Liberty Tunnels. And driving home, we'd be driving through the Liberty Tunnels, and I'd be changing into my football uniform to go to Little League. And so, and then I grew up. I, sixth grade, I was in the high school musical of Oliver. I always joke I was one of the, you know, the main cast, because they kicked a freshman out. I forget what he did, but since I was one of the bigger kids, I got a couple lines as one of the orphans. I got to be Charlie Bates. And so my name got in the program.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I got exposed to that. But of course, when high school rolls around, and the chorus teacher, you know, invited me to join chorus, I'm like, no way.
Yeah. What was that? What was the report? Was it, what was the resistance to that?
It was that, you know, that masculinity piece, you know, it's like, you know, those guys in chorus especially, are a little limp-wrist. Yeah. No, I can't be with them. But not realizing, it's like, dude, you know, the girls that are in that. So what about the guys?
I know, right?
They would have had access to all these pretty hot girls.
And it's kind of funny. You enjoyed it before.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're like, nah, bro, that's not for me. Yeah. And what year was that?
That would have been freshman year in high school. Freshman that I was invited for that. So somewhere between sixth grade and freshman year. That's, I mean, I still enjoy
it. In the 70s, right? You're,
yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah. Oh, that year. Yeah. Yeah, that would have been, I was born in 63. I don't know what year would that be.
Probably 77.
70. No, it would have been earlier than that. I graduated in 81. So doing the math back.
Yeah. 4 years back.
My inability to do this math, you should probably edit out.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, it was probably like 71, 72.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe later than that.
Yeah. If you graduated 81 minus 4,
freshman year was probably what, 76?
77,
or so?
76. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Should know that well, because it's, you know, bicentennial year. All that exciting stuff happened.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the best running years, too.
Oh, yeah? Did you run?
You
did track.
I did track, but it wasn't that great at it. I mean, I did the 800 and 400 for the first 2 years and, you know, kind of evolved toward field events.
Sure.
And I was horrible at field events. But we used to do, on the 4th of July, this 24-hour marathon relay. Teams of 10 where you just run a mile, hand it off, and every 10th mile you're running again. Mm-hmm. You do that through the night for 24 hours.
It's fun.
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, I loved it. And I think I ran my fastest mile ever at about 2 in the morning. I ran like a 5:15. And I mean, normally I couldn't run a 6.5 mile, but somehow I was just so out of it that I just went and ran.
Oh my God.
So you
said your dad was pretty cool with just whatever sports he wanted to do and never really pushed you too hard in that respect?
No, I don't remember ever being pushed. I mean, I played Little League football from third grade on. He coached. He was a really good Little League coach. Hmm. He coached baseball, but I think he knew not to push me in that direction. Yeah. And I have no idea how I kind of found my way to wrestling. That started probably around fourth or fifth grade.
Yeah.
It was probably one of those things we got to do it after school. And I liked it. And, you know, Coach Kling, my varsity coach, had just gotten to the school district and was starting the youth program. And, you know, I just enjoyed it and got into it. And freshman year, my dad was like, look, you're tall. You know, you should be playing basketball. Why don't you give it a try? And I'm like, I don't want to play basketball. Just try it.
Yeah.
So I tried it. I went all out, did the best I could. I made it to the final cuts. And then the final sprints that we had to do, they had this, you know, if you won your line, you didn't have to run anymore. So I'm just going sprinting all out. And this was in the middle school gym where there was a divider at the end of the gym. We used to actually wrestle behind this curtain that was at the end of the gym. But there were also steel poles that were supporting that area. And I ran square on into one of those poles. So I was knocked out for about a minute or so. And I was back before any concussion.
Oh, yeah, that's not a thing.
Or anything like that. So, you know, I just kind of got up, went home, and told my dad I was cut from the team.
Hey, I'm done.
It's like, can I wrestle now?
Yeah, yeah.
And he laughs. He said, I've never seen a kid so happy to get cut from a team.
That's funny.
But, you know, it's just, it wasn't my personality.
Yeah.
And it's funny, it's not my son's personality either, and he's tall as can be, too.
Yeah,
he comes up to probably the bridge of my nose now.
Yeah, how old is he?
He's 12. He'll be 13 in July.
Oh, he's only 12?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was older than that for some reason. That's why I saw him. I'm like, oh, he looks like he's like 16 years old.
Yeah, he's a big kid. So he's loving wrestling and lacrosse. Those are his areas.
Oh,
so.
Nice. Nice. It's cool he has the opportunity to play lacrosse.
Yeah.
Because that's not that common around here.
It's getting more common.
Yeah. That's more of a Northeast thing, right?
Much more, yeah. I mean, in Pittsburgh, growing up there, we didn't have lacrosse.
Right. Oh, okay.
We didn't have soccer either. No, we always worked. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. My senior year was the first year they had soccer, and the only reason we had soccer, we had these two brothers from Italy.
Oh.
Like, I think about a half dozen kids that had immigrated from Vietnam.
So you just wanted to win? Yeah. You're like, we need a team?
No, they wanted to play soccer.
Yeah.
So they got the school to allow them. They had to be a club team, I think, the first year, and they probably would have won the States that year, had they. And then the second year, I forget how they did because I had graduated already, but they had a really solid team for a couple years.
Yeah.
And then these guys graduate and there was nothing left. Oh, and so they had to wait a few years before they got some decent soccer players. But they had some decent guys. They had one guy, the goalie, was probably the only good Native American, born in the U.S.
What's the label now? Indigenous? I don't know.
I can't even say that because I was going to say Native American. It's like, well, no, he's not Native American. But,
born
here.
Yeah.
He ended up playing goalie for Cleveland in their indoor league.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, talent.
So legit.
There's like no backing on that.
Yeah.
I'm sure they coached themselves. I don't think there was
they
a
were
decent
good enough.
Coach in
yeah,
the
yeah, yeah. Learning in the schoolyard. I'm always kind of interested because I was a basketball player.
Yeah.
Well, I played basketball. I was horrible, but it was always the interesting tension between the wrestlers and the basketball players.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had that. And that, I don't know if that gets bred into you or if it's just natural. But
they happen at the same time here, right? So you're kind of occupying the same physical space a little bit.
Sort of, yeah. But especially that junior, my seventh and eighth grade years, I think it was eighth grade that we wrestled in that behind that curtain area where I ran into the pole my freshman year. And so we'd have the mats in there, and invariably a ball would come rolling into that curtain. And at the start of the season, guy would come charging in there all cocky to get the ball and just pounce on him. And then by the end of the season, they'd be out there, you get the ball. I'm not getting the ball. You get the ball. And the coach would kind of just like walk out.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know, it just developed that animosity. But when I got to high school, we had a varsity basketball coach he was a good coach, and I think he was a respected coach, and I'm sure some of my perceptions of him were distorted.
Yeah.
But I always felt that he like looked down to the wrestlers. And particularly, I think he feel like he looked down to me as being like, here's one of the tallest guys in the school.
Yeah.
And he's wrestling. And the basketball team, they'd be coming down from practice in the gym, and we'd be going up to the pool deck or somewhere to run. We're just drenched in sweat. They got a couple beads of sweat on their nose.
Yeah.
And they're complaining about how hard their practice is. And we're like, you're kidding me. We're not even done yet.
We're not
Look
even
at this.
Done.
So it
seems like that's where a lot of that first initial like bro measuring up thing happens too between those sports. It was it's kind of funny to watch. I knew how bad I was at basketball, so it didn't really matter to me. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. I'm a runner anyway, so you guys just go do your thing.
Yeah.
But just observationally, it's where a lot of that, like I observed it, it was kind of funny.
Yeah. But it's funny, though. I love women's basketball. Like, I watch that, and I think it, and people laugh at me when I say I think it's a more physical sport.
Oh, well, I agree, thinking about it, because this is like a tricky area. They're not as explosively like high flying and stuff as men, right?
It's not these fast break, slam dunk, and then another fast break and slam dunk.
Right, so you actually have to play more physical basketball. Yeah. You're more around people more often, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just a different watch.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, I don't know why, they don't like it. Like it at all.
I like it.
Yeah, and did you have girls on the wrestling team?
No. I kind of wrestled prior, it was just as girls were starting to enter into the sport and the resistance that they were, receiving. And, and now, I mean, I'm fully supportive of women in wrestling.
Yeah.
I was introduced through a friend of mine. to a woman, Sally Roberts, who used to wrestle for the U.S. national team. Mm-hmm. She has a foundation now that she's been working just full steam ahead, trying to get more and more women's wrestling.
What's the name of the foundation?
Across country. It's Wrestle Like a Girl.
Wrestle Like a Girl.
So she's doing a phenomenal job, and it's just, you know, hugely supportive of that. Yeah. I think, you know, women's wrestling is an awesome sport.
Yeah.
And I struggle with the women wrestling men.
Yeah.
Not from the standpoint of they can't, but, you know, it really puts both the male and the female in an awkward situation. And so to me, we need to really be promoting the opportunities for women to have their own team, their own sport, their own state championships.
Sure.
And, you know, their own competitions against comparables.
Yeah.
Because for a guy, I mean, at the lighter weights, you know, women can beat the guys.
Yeah.
If you're 106 pounds, you know, there's not going to be much difference physically between 106 pound male and 106 pound female.
Sure.
And so, yeah, you've got a good shot of getting beat.
Yeah.
Now, if you're wrestling, you know, in the weight class I wrestle 185, it's probably less likely that the woman is going to have any kind of advantage. She'd be more likely to be much more disadvantaged than the male. But, yeah, it'd have to be awkward. I mean, I can't imagine being, you know, 15, 16, you know, in the height of puberty, rolling around on a mat with a girl.
Yeah.
And not getting somewhat aroused.
I know. It'd be so hard. I think of the same thing. And not only that, too, but just like, even I'm never a big guy. I was probably this high size in high school, but I would still be like, I don't want to hurt this person. And that's not maybe the right way to think about it, but like still it would have been going through my mind.
Yeah.
And I think especially with like more combat oriented sports, that it's just so, it's dangerous. Like you can't have a 160 pound woman and a 160 pound man wrestling, or, you know, and like wrestling is not quite combat, but it's
that's a combat sport,
close, right? Right. Yeah. It's not MMA, but at the same time, like it's also not, they're not running against each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough, but a lot of people want it just, equal. Well, yeah, but physiological differences that are make it pretty dangerous too.
I had issues with the whole equality terminology.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it should be equity, not equality. I mean, you cannot say that everybody is equal, but certainly they should be treated with equity. And
right,
you know,
right. Well, there's nuance in everything, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think what we have, like, some men that are completely threatened by having their power taken away. And other guys are like, well, yeah, we should be all equal, but there's also, we need to acknowledge differences.
Yeah.
Like, but then there's people way out on the other end who are just like, no, no differences. It's like, okay.
I think unfortunately in our society, it's those most extreme voices that are the loudest.
Yeah. Well, they catch attention, right?
Whoops.
Don't worry about that. It's empty anyways. Coffee fell. But yeah, they catch the attention, right? That's the newsflash. That's the viral tweet or the whatever.
Yeah.
And you then now mix in, especially in wrestling, I think this has happened a little bit about genders, like transgender issues too. When I'm do what you want to do, that's great. But then you have, you know, men who have transitioned to women who want to wrestle women or fight women.
Yeah.
And it's like,
it's,
I don't know what to do with that. I honestly don't know.
It's a difficult argument. And, personally, I mean, I don't know where I stand with it, because if a man is transitioning to female and he's taking female hormones, I mean, there's enough physiological evidence that as soon as you start taking those female hormones, you're going to lose a significant amount of that maleness, you know, if that's the right word for it, you know, that physical advantage that a male would have. And you're basically bringing yourself down.
You're just testosterone dropping? Is that what that is?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And so you're losing muscle mass and you're losing things like that. And I think it also potentially negates the accomplishments of women in the sport, basically saying that, well, we can't compete with this male who's the same weight as me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, if you took, you know, a male, you know, fresh out of puberty, you know, all loaded up on testosterone and has been lifting weights and things like that.
Just
and suddenly
monster.
Decides I want to wrestle. Yeah. You know, I identify as a female wrestler and I want to wrestle women. That would be, you know, horribly wrong.
Sure.
But, you know, in the cases where somebody has wanted to, like, there was a big case in Texas. I can't remember the exact name of the weight class of the individual, but she had transitioned from male to female. Had transitioned from female to male is what it was. Was transitioning to male.
Yeah.
And they, by rules, you have to wrestle in the gender that you were born.
That's a Texas rule.
It's a Texas rule. And so they didn't permit her. Or how was it? It had to be him then.
Yeah. She transitioned to a male.
Yeah. Yeah,
they didn't permit him.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have been an obstacle. But
yeah.
See, so was transitioning to male and had to wrestle the women and just tore everything up.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, what do you do in that situation? You wanted to wrestle, you know, the males, but they forced her to wrestle, or him, to wrestle the females.
Ugh.
And so it gets very muddied in there in terms of who should wrestle where. And you have some of the same things when we come to track and field.
Well, there's that professional runner.
Yeah.
She's Kester Semenya, I think her name is, from South Africa. She's born a female, but she's like, she has like either elevated testosterone. That's like, something's going on, right?
Yeah.
And at one point they wanted to gender test her. People are like, whoa. You can't just run around gender testing people. So I don't know if they did, if she ended up submitting to that, but she still runs with the women. I just saw her run and she destroyed everybody. But
yeah, I think I have the advanced topics and exercise physiology class. I don't know if you would have taken that or not. I've gone different ways with how I've taught that. But this past year, we took the book, The Sports Gene by, why would I draw a blank on his name? Maybe I'll think of it, but the Sports Gene, and it goes through talking about, you know, why Jamaicans are great runners, Kenyans are great runners. Yeah. It talks about
looks at like some, leg length and stuff like that, doesn't it? Yeah.
Tons of things, and you look at some of these female runners that have the elevated testosterone. Many of them, it is a testosterone insensitivity that causes that. They're biologically female, but then you run across, you know, chromosome issues. I mean, there's a lot of different issues that causes stuff. Yeah. It's not a matter of somebody's out there to get a competitive edge by changing their gender. I mean, there is no competitive edge to saying I'm going to change my gender and compete in a different gender.
And with this, with this one's too, it's like, it's so rare.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's this one person maybe ever in the sport.
Yeah.
And of course it gets a lot of attention, but it's like something we never think about. It's something we never address and just hope it goes away. But it seems to be getting, you know, these gender issues are getting more coming to light that we probably should talk about them or address them a little bit better than we have.
Yes. You know, what do we do now? We have, you know, we have Paralympics and Special Olympics, and we have the regular Olympics. Should we now have the gender androgynous Olympics?
I don't think so. I think that might cause some problems.
Sounds almost humorous. It sounds like a Saturday Night Live sketch or something. But
like,
I mean, what do you do? I mean, people are people, and you know, we don't complain when somebody has a genetic, you know, advantage.
Right.
You know, somebody is born. Well, they're not born 7 feet tall, but, you know, genetically they grow to be, you know, 7 feet tall.
Yeah.
You know, we don't say that's an unfair advantage in basketball. We
take
advantage of it, you know.
What was it, too? Like Dean Karnazzi, the ultra runner, he, like, doesn't produce lactic acid.
Oh, yeah. I think I've heard of him.
It's just like, of course he can run forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
do you ban him because he...
Exactly.
You know, or somebody that has... Yeah, I mean, the Kenyan runners, we banned them because they were fortunate enough to be born at the right altitude with the right limb length and, you know, hip proportions and, you know, the right hematocrit and
all that.
Oh, you're too good to run in this sport. You know, it's like you deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, and so we don't win for a while. We find a way to compete better. Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we just need to talk about it, though, and not get angry.
No.
And people, I mean, just because it seems like, especially with the gender, people just get angry so quick.
Yeah. And they don't consider, you know, how's this person feel?
Yeah.
You know, they didn't choose to be born that way.
Yeah.
You know, and well, you can make the argument, well, they didn't choose, you know, they did choose to change their gender, but there's a lot of issues that we don't understand that go into that. And the reality is, yeah, they, you know, is it, you know, just the penis or a vagina that makes you a male or a female, you know, or if you change your hormone levels. I mean, you have guys who have all the parts, but they don't have quite the hormone levels that other guys do.
Yeah.
So
it's funny. Yeah. We're starting to just discover there's a lot of nuance in gender.
Yeah.
It's not a A or B, it's a, on a scale.
Right.
It seems so. Yeah. That's complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you guys discuss any of this back where you were growing up? Any of this type of, I mean, what were you guys talking about over there on the East Coast?
Oh yeah. I mean, that was so long ago, you know, growing up. I mean, I think right now I'm your oldest person you've had a conversation with so far. I was kind of monitoring, listening to all six of the ones you've already posted. And I was like, they're progressively getting older.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming the next person you interview is going to be like 60 or something.
No, not yet. I got to get my grandpa on here though.
So,
I need to edit that one, but
you know, we weren't having those kind of discussions. I'm not even sure what we were discussing back then.
Yeah.
I mean, God, it was probably, you know, stupid teenage kid.
Sure.
And we were discussing, you know, Saturday Night Live and the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the classic movies and all the best music. I mean, honestly, I think, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s,
when prime music time.
Oh, prime for everything.
Yeah.
I mean, television, movies, comedy.
TV's pretty good now, though.
Yeah.
They're making some good shows.
There's a lot
now.
Of good shows, but there's almost too much of it.
That's the problem. It's like, what do I even watch? Yeah. None of it.
You know, I don't think your generation, well, your generation probably understands it some, but yeah, these younger kids coming up, yeah, they don't understand. That, you know, we used to wait until Thursday night for Seinfeld to be on.
I know. You know? No, even the people, some of the people I work with are like six to 7 years younger than me. Yeah. I'll mention something and I'm like, they're like, I don't get it. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, oh my God.
So we've kind of lost some of that delayed gratification.
Yeah.
You know, and if you missed a show, you had to wait until the springtime when the reruns came around to see it again.
Yeah.
And now I could... You know, I just blew through the 13th season of Supernatural. It was like, crap, now I got to wait
until next year.
So, it's, you know, we live on Netflix. We've cut the cable. We have Netflix, Hulu.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, but we found my kids were doing on-demand all the time.
Yeah.
We're paying all this for cable, and cable was a big headache.
Not even using it.
Yeah, and so we just one day, I was on hold for hours, trying to just deal with, I think we were trying to return the free DVR player that we had gotten when we signed up. And it was just on hold forever.
Comcast?
Honestly, I don't remember. Sounds I don't think it was Comcast. I mean, I think we had an issue with Comcast.
Of course, everyone has an issue with Comcast.
I think it was Fios maybe at the time. I shouldn't probably be putting down any of these companies.
I'll put them down.
Okay.
I'll take it for that. Comcast sucks. Everyone knows that.
We have Frontier now, and we just have them for our cable, and that's it.
Yep.
But we just finally said, enough's enough. I'm on hold, and I'm on the phone, and my wife gets online and searches, you know, TVs and researches them, and we had a buddy that was manager at the Sony store, and they still had Sony stores, and we drove over to Bridgeport Village and went into the Sony store, still holding my phone, still on hold, ordered the TV, bought the TV, and scheduled to have it delivered and installed, and finally I got dropped on my call. But I mean, I literally was on hold all this time that we took to make this decision to just cut the cable and get
hooked up,
TV,
and you're already surfing, still on hold.
Yeah, I watched, you know, a season of Supernatural, and we're still on hold.
Yeah. But, you know, the times were different back when you were a kid, but having stuff like that available now is pretty nice.
It is nice.
Yeah.
I mean, it allows you more flexibility in your life, and it's just how you use it.
Yeah, but it sounds like, though, with your friends, and it's a lot of the same stuff we talked about.
I'm sure.
You know,
yeah.
There's boys are little monsters.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's important to let boys talk about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Whether they're talking about sex or girls or whatever. I mean, there's some of it that's maybe not great, but it always kind of worked itself out.
Yeah.
You know, there's always some guys who kind of shied away from it, or other guys who would, you know, really go hard. But,
yeah,
I think you got to let them work it out a little bit.
And I don't think we do that well enough.
Let kids go.
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
I mean, let them have those conversations. Let them, you know, I don't say fight out some of the details, but
yeah.
You know, there are times when we can completely restrict kids from having conflict.
Yeah.
And, you know, school systems now, it's like, you know, we're bully-free zone and zero tolerance and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, I understand minimizing bullying and that bullying is a bad thing, but there's certain elements of maturity that we can learn from it, you know, in both ends. I mean, the bully needs to learn to kind of control his or her rage.
Yeah.
And the kid who's being bullied needs to learn to deal with it.
Sure.
And, you know, we need, and I think you had conversation in your last conversation at episode 6, you were talking a bit about, you know, these need for these conversations with kids and the need for kids to, you know, be able to resolve conflict, to be rejected, deal with rejection.
Right.
And kids aren't getting rejected.
Right.
And then when they do, then they snap.
Yeah. Well, and specifically, do you think that's affecting boys more?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's affecting boys because, I mean, you look at, you know, who's pulling off these school shootings? It's not girls.
No, it's angry little
it's
men.
It's angry white boys.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, and I think culturally there might be different ways that, you know, these kids are dealing with it. I mean, you know, you look in some of the more minority populations are drawn more to gangs and some of that. And I think there's other issues that kind of lend themselves to that opportunity and, and you know, what that means for them. But we have these kids that are just, they're growing up. We're in this, everybody gets a trophy age.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's self-esteem needs, you know, we need to protect self-esteem and, you know, make sure everybody feels good about themselves and, you know, no conflict. You know, zero tolerance for any kind of conflict in the schools. And we tell our kids they're perfect. And then suddenly somebody tells them they're not perfect and they snap.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's sad. I mean, I think it's important that we tell our kids that, you know, your shit doesn't smell like roses.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You're not perfect, but...
And life's going to be hard.
Yeah, life's hard. You got to work at it a bit. And
but if you're never given the tools to deal with how hard life is... That's, you know, that's a big, big, big problem. You know, I was just, you just posted that video this morning.
Yeah.
And I watched it. But then, of course, like YouTube, you know, it just starts playing everything that's related to that. And I just was letting it play. And the video said that the World Health Organization said that men are 4 times more likely to commit suicide. And some of that kind of hit home with just recently with Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
That was just like... mention that too later, but and then there's been a 60% increase in male suicide over the last 45 years alone.
Wow.
And it's because like a lot of males, they turn and they don't have like a best friend that they can even identify in their life. But it's like a lot of those conflicts that boys have, I mean, at least for me, is that I ended up being best friends with some of those people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We worked our shit out and then we were good buddies afterwards. You know, it was like relationship building in a way.
Yeah, I was thinking recently, I was kind of scrolling over all the different people that I'm friends with on Facebook. Yeah. And I got a lot of friends from high school that we just kind of reconnected with.
Yeah.
And just thinking of the number of them that I had fights with growing up.
Right.
I mean, I remember, you know, one friend, you know, Larry Harden that I'm still friends with, I think it was seventh or eighth grade. He broke his thumb on my jaw, you know, but we're friends now. and I, elementary school, being forced to, and literally, like, kind of forced. We were, like, peer pressured into fighting. Neither of us really wanted to fight. I don't know what the conflict was, but...
It's an odd thing to be peer pressured into.
End up getting in a fight with Kenny Yee, who, you know, neither of us wanted to fight, but he more or less kicked my butt. He could throw a punch. And, you know, we just exchanged punches for a while, and then finally we're just like, this is insane. I'm done. He's done. And we walked away from it, like, arm in arm.
Right.
Just like
brothers in a fight, like, kind of, you know what I mean? Yeah, and I'm certainly not advocating bullying, and I don't think you are either. And there's probably levels of that, right? Where there's some vicious bullying going on, but there's also just like the little teasing, the light teasing. It's not, you know, I just think there's a level of it that's okay. Yeah. It's just going to happen.
Well, and some of that teasing, I know for myself personally, I mean, I look back over what I did as a teenager and, you know, older, young child, and some of the stuff that I did and the things that I did to people would have had me expelled from school. I'd have probably been in military academy or in juvenile hall or something for stuff. And I was considered a nice kid growing up. I mean, my mom told me once that the mothers of girls would tell her, you know, what a gentleman I was and all this stuff, that I would hold their, help hold doors for them and, you know, help them with their coats, which I don't remember any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, having three sisters, that was kind of ingrained into me. But, you know, you had those habits. But it's still, I mean, I did all the stuff a boy would do.
Yeah.
You know, got into fights over things. And
you were allowed to make mistakes.
Yeah, and you grew from it.
Yeah.
You know, you wrestled around, you fought, you, you know, called each other names.
Yeah. Did your parents tell you when you were messing up?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's important.
They told me, and they usually expressed it with a wooden spoon or a paddle. But, you know, that was that was all part of growing up. I mean, there was discipline, but, you know, you learned what the line was and when it's appropriate to cross it.
Sure. I'm wondering then now, you as a father of a boy, like one boy?
One boy, yeah.
One boy, do you have a...
One boy and a girl.
So
I have a 12-year-old boy and a 10-year-old girl going on 18.
Fun. Yeah. So with, I guess, you know, with your boy, since that's what we're talking about, how do you let them kind of be upset with the world, or how do you let them... Because I think if you don't tell them, you know, hey, life is hard, then they can... like we said, lose, not develop those tools and get to a place where they're super depressed and not know what to do.
Yeah.
So how do you let them feel a little bit of pain and also say, hey, I'm here, but not like baby them as well.
And I'm sure
how do you approach that? I guess I should say,
I'm sure I have done everything that I'm not supposed to do.
Yeah.
But you know, I think I'm doing okay with it. He's a fairly well-adjusted kid. I mean, I probably yell much more than I should and stuff like that. And I, you know, make clear to him I have high expectations. But, you know, one example, and I've used this in class a few times, and, you know, I'm sure anybody listening to this is going to think I'm just such a horrible father. But it was one of his, I think it was his first or second year, probably his second year of wrestling. I pick him up and, you know, he was upset and he said, so-and-so said I suck. And I looked at him and said, well, you do. And looks at me like, what? I said, well, you know, I watch you and you're not drilling hard. You're not doing what you're supposed to. You're not working hard. Yeah, you suck because you're not trying. But if you try, you won't. You know, you'll get better. You'll get good. But yeah, unless you start working at it, you will suck.
Yeah.
So don't expect me to sit here and say you don't.
And that was one of those things too, where you knew he had more to give.
Yeah.
You knew it.
Right.
So it's always like, sometimes you got to tell people, hey, you know, you could have done better.
Yeah.
You could have not sucked. And here's how.
Yeah. And I think I balance it, but I mean, I tell him to go out and fail.
Yeah.
I want him to fail.
Yeah.
And because if he's not failing, he's not growing. He's not trying.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this season in lacrosse, he had played goalie for last few years, and he's a really good goalie.
Mm-hmm.
But he was kind of hesitant to play goalie this year. He wanted to try playing the field more, and all the preseason stuff, he was in the field. And they ended up assigning him to a team where they assigned one kid as goalie and put him at midfield, which is fine because he's a fast runner. He's good. He doesn't have great stick handling skills yet, but you know, he's a pretty decent athlete.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, he'd be a great long stick middie. I don't know how much you know about lacrosse.
I know nothing.
But they allow four long sticks or long poles on the field. Three would be defensemen, and one could be a long stick middie. That the midfielders, like in soccer, they'll, you know, they're on the face off, and then they usually the long stick will go off the field if they win the face off, or they'll stay on in defense. And I thought, you know, he has the body type, the speed, and ground skills to be able to be a decent long stick middie. So I was encouraging him to get out and use his long stick. And I got him a new head for it and everything. And, you know, we're out there and he was really hesitant to use it. And I'm like, what's the problem? It's like, you know, I'm just not comfortable with it. I'm like, dude, that's how you get better.
Yeah.
You know, if you're comfortable, you're not getting better. So be uncomfortable with it. Yeah. Try it.
Yeah.
And I think it was like the next week they had an extra game where they had to play one of their own Westland teams, and it ended up being more of just a scrimmage. But he had always took all three sticks with him, his goalie stick, his attack stick, and his long stick. And he had the long pole out with him and decided he was going to play defense that game. And he hasn't put down the long stick since. They put him the next, you know, regular team game. They put him at defense, and coaches were like, he was our best defenseman that day.
Yeah.
You know, he just was hustling and just playing well. And he just like, that's all he needed.
Sure.
He's just to push that extra little bit.
Yeah.
And he realized he was pretty decent at it.
Yeah. There's I also read this other I was listening to this other podcast, cause I'm all deep into podcasts. Like, yeah. I barely listen to music anymore. It's pretty much all podcasts, which is a problem cause I'm always thinking, but they mentioned that there's this article, this study that they did that showed that boys or probably just young people really benefit from risk-taking behavior,
mm-hmm.
and how it teaches them so much to be a little bit afraid of something when they're doing it, you know, almost dangerous stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, like your son might've been a little bit afraid at the time to try something new.
Yeah.
It seemed a little risky, but then he sees the results from it.
Yeah. Well, he's an overly, I wouldn't say overly cautious kid, but he's a very cautious kid.
Yeah.
He has to think things through. Yeah. That's why football is not really working for him, because he has to, you know, in football, you make a mistake, you know, you're basically yelled at.
Sure.
Immediately. You can't correct anything. Nobody tells you what to do right the next time. They
yeah.
just tell you what you just did wrong. And his mind just doesn't work that way. Whereas in wrestling, you know, if he makes a mistake, yeah, he gets taken down, but he can
kind of make up
quickly correct that.
Yeah.
You know, or he gets pinned, but. You know, yeah. He learns from it. You know, they say in wrestling that there's only winners and learners. There's no losers.
I like that.
And lacrosse is kind of the same thing. You make a mistake, you know, even at goalie. I mean, he had a pretty high percentage of stops, but he was a good goalie.
Yeah.
But, you know, balls are going to get past you.
Yeah.
You can't do anything but just pick up stick and keep at it.
Sure.
And so for him, that gets him past that having to overthink things.
Yeah.
But he's just has that tendency to, you know, I got to think it through and be overly, you know, conscious of everything mm-hmm. that he's doing. I mean, we saw this as a kid. We first decided we were going to move out this way. We're thinking about moving out this way. It was actually more toward retirement, but we went up to Hood Canal in Washington and we're staying at this resort. And at the end of the bed, there was this couch that had like an L-shaped back on it.
Yep.
And my son was probably maybe two at the time, one or maybe one. But he's walking on the back of that thing. And, you know, he's very cautious in walking and, you know, looking at what he's doing. But my wife and I are looking at it. Like, most parents would be freaking out. Like, yeah. Oh, wow, watch yourself. You're going to, you know,
yeah,
you're gonna
hurt yourself.
And we're just like, huh, look at that. How cool. And we just kind of let him yeah. do it. But he's got to think his way through yeah. and, you know, he's going to maybe be a little bit slower at doing things that are risky.
Sure.
But once he gets past the fear, then
yeah.
he moves forward.
That's interesting. That's a good observation to make about him, though.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's helped as a parent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, thinking about as from a father perspective, what do you worry about most with him?
I think probably what I worry most about with him is that he's just going to sell himself short.
Yeah.
You know, not do all he's capable of doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does that sometimes. And if he doesn't like something, like right now we're having a battle with math.
Sure.
Which seems to be across the state.
Across the world.
Yeah. It just, he just is not liking math, and so mm-hmm. he's not doing the work. And, you know, we have to fight with them to get everything turned in, because you know, yeah. now they allow you to turn everything in really late
sure.
and still pass the class. No consequences
to anything, yeah.
And so, yeah, just I'm afraid that he's going to think that he can't do that
yeah.
and then just give up on it. Yeah. And I'd rather him learn that anything worth life in worthwhile in life is going to have a struggle involved with it. Sure. You've got to work at it to learn it and overcome it. But once you overcome it, then there's that reward of having overcome it.
So the things that I've done that have been easy haven't really been,
they're not worthwhile.
I don't even remember them really. So yeah, that's that's pretty good though. You must have a lot of trust in him. I mean, on the baseline,
overall.
Do you feel like some of that too, a little bit of worry that he might not achieve what he's capable of? Did that come from looking back on you as a young man with the wrestling thing that you maybe you wishing you had given a little bit more, or where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I'd say it's absolutely probably from me.
Yeah.
I grew up, it's funny. My wife and I, when we were getting set to get married, I think it was before we got married, we did this workshop. There's a book called Getting the Love You Want by Harville Hendrix. Mm. And they do workshops kind of parallel to that. And you just go through a bunch of different exercises and things like that. And you work together as a couple to kind of understand, because it comes from the standpoint that the people we're best matched with are probably people that are kind of most opposite from us.
Sure.
And that opposition sometimes becomes a separation point instead of what brings you together.
Yeah.
And so just kind of understanding how each other ticks can go a long way. Sure. And it was a great exercise for us. In fact, I'd recommend it for anybody that's, in a relationship, getting married. But one of the exercises we had to do was to list any of the negative talk we received growing up. And I was struggling. It's like, I don't remember any. Honestly, I could not remember for the life of me, and I still can't, any real negative talk I got from my parents. If anything, I felt like they were less realistic about what I could do. And maybe, that was my own personal doubts in myself. But, the only thing that came to mind was my mother saying, "You're just like your father." And I got to backtrack on that a bit. I mean, my parents are divorced, and they had a pretty ugly divorce. And they got married very early. They were married at 19 because, they got pregnant with my older sister. And, there was never really that full compatibility there. But they ended up, I think they were married 20 years or so. They pretty much stayed together as long as they could for the kids. And, I would hear from my mother all the time, "You're just like your father. You're just like your father." And it would negate all the positive things I hear from both of my parents because, I'm also hearing from her, all this negative stuff about my father, which, in some cases may have been accurate, in other cases not accurate. But I perceived that as saying, okay, no matter how much you're telling me I'm a good person and all this stuff, I'm not.
Right. Well, it would have been a compliment had they been together and were super close, but
you're just like your father.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thanks, Mom.
Thanks, Mom.
You're just like your father. So, thanks, Mom.
Yeah, you're just like your father.
So, that just struck me as, wow, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Because my dad, it's kind of hard to express, the history of their story there, but my dad has done some amazing things. Mm. And he's a guy that has always kind of gone for that brass ring and never ever really quite gotten it. Mm. And it's easy to look at the fact that he hasn't gotten the brass ring and see that as a negative, as opposed to what I've learned to look at is like all the opportunities he's taken to reach for it that people don't do.
Yeah.
And I've kind of learned for myself that, it doesn't matter if you get the brass ring. It's the fact that you're making the effort and you're trying these things to do it. And my dad, he had a tryout with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Oh, wow.
And this, probably back in the 60s sometimes, having never played high school or college football.
Jesus.
he tried out as a kicker and, it was a couple of days in camp. It wasn't like, they had a free, everybody just come out and, it's just a publicity kind of stunt. He actually got to go to camp for a couple of days before he got cut. And he's done stuff. When he retired, his wife had, she had taken a job in New York as the CFO for the YWCA. Mm-hmm. She had directed the facility in Pittsburgh, took that position, and they fired the CEO. And so she ended up stepping into that position. So they were living in New York City for, I think they lived there about 3 years before she retired from that. And then they went down to DC for a while. But while they're in New York, I mean, he had a consulting business for probably 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And you can't just kind of pick that up and then move to a different city and reestablish it. So he was old enough, he kind of just more or less went into retirement. Yeah. And she suggested that maybe he, you know, try getting into some acting. And he had acted some when he was younger. I mean, my dad, he tells stories about, I don't know if you know who Flip Wilson is.
I've heard of it. I've heard the name. I've heard the name.
Great comedian from the yeah. 60s. Geraldine was one of his popular roles where he dressed in drag and all that stuff. And, you know, my dad actually performed with him at the Holiday House in Pittsburgh.
Oh, that's cool.
And got to talk with them. And he was probably one of the first people to see Geraldine because they were talking. And, you know, Flip Wilson was telling about this new bit he's working on. And I had always understood the story that my dad told me it would never work.
Yeah.
But I was wrong about that. Apparently, he did just say it was hysterical and he just laughed about it. But, you know, so he had done that. He did some acting, like community stage work and stuff when he was younger, but nothing really major.
Yeah.
Well, he goes to New York and just, you know, signs up to gets an agent and gets some extra work. And ends up, he was a regular extra on Law and Order Criminal Intent, where, I mean, every episode he was on there somewhere, had his own desk in the show and everything. Done a number of episodes with the other Law and Orders, Special Victims Unit.
Yeah.
Forget what, tons of different shows he was on. He's been in movies.
He's just out there doing cool stuff.
Yeah, it's just amazing stuff. I mean, just coming so close. There was the movie with the Douglases, Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas, and Cameron Douglas. I think it was called It's Part of the Family.
Yeah, okay.
Where, you know, it's just all this family dynamics between three generations of this family. And the mother dies and there's a wake for her at the house.
Yeah.
And my dad is at the table with the Douglases. He's like the only extra kind of sitting at that table. And he's like throughout the whole scene, he's kind of the back, you know, quarter of his head.
Yeah.
And I think he actually may have had a line that was cut from the overall movie, but he said, you know, Kirk Douglas requested him at that table.
Oh, my God.
And then there's another scene where you can see him talking with somebody.
Yeah.
And he's in Wedding Crashers where there's like...
What?
There's a few frames of that movie where he's the only one on the camera. And it's like so cool. And like my sister-in-law saw it in the theater and didn't know he was in the movie.
And then
blurts out real loud, "That's Bill Armstrong!" And so he's done a bunch of those different movies. Yeah. Now he does some, a little bit of just kind of, he does the senior circuit. Does some performances. He's got this character Bucked Off that he does. And
Bucked
he's
off.
Done some videos. And yeah, but he's written some books and he's done all
just
his stuff.
Life.
And it's like, okay, yeah, he's never, you know, doesn't have a bestseller.
Yeah.
He's never had a speaking role in a, you know, prime movie.
He's living the way he wants to live, though.
He's living happy. He's trying things. He's doing things. And, you know, I'm hugely proud of him for all that. And there were times in my life where I was, like, doubting him.
Yeah, oh, really?
And I allowed that doubt to kind of creep into me.
Huh.
And, you know, I've kind of experienced the same thing. You know, or my career hasn't really gone all that far.
Yeah.
And I have doubts often, you know, am I doing anything of any great worth?
Yeah.
You know, it's not as frequent that you have students that, you know, say that, you know, you had an impact on them or anything like that. And so, you know, I'm sure I carry that over to my son. I don't want him to feel like a failure at any point.
Yeah.
But I think I've learned that, you know, if you're living your life with purpose and accomplishing what you're put on this earth to do, you know, your purpose may not be to be a celebrity, to be a big star, to not be wealthy. You know, even just coming here, when we moved to Oregon, we moved here believing that this is what we were supposed to do and that there was a purpose in coming out here. And for me, and, you know, it's not really happened.
Right.
And I've struggled with that. I was like, well, geez.
Well,
what am I doing here? But then I realize, okay, maybe I'm not here for me.
Yeah.
Maybe it's for my kids.
You know,
the experiences, the relationships that they're making are shaping who they're to become.
Mm.
And so in the whole scheme of things, you know, well, my purpose is to get them here so that this experience happens that's going to do something years down the line.
It sounds like you're pretty accepting of that, if that is the case.
Yeah, I'm very accepting
which,
of that.
Which, to me, is a very, you know, masculine thing,
yeah,
is to be selfless. But like I said, when I sat down, you know, you have had an impact. You're a passionate teacher.
Yeah.
And that's like, I'm telling you, that's so important. I've just had, my dad was a teacher, and he was just, I got to see the, you know, at a classroom, Tom, and how much he cared, how much time he spent lesson planning,
yeah,
all the little intricacies he put into it. And I can see that you put that sort of thing into it. You know, you get creative with what about Bob, the heavyweights and, yeah, stuff like that to engage people. And it's like, it matters. So
I just like those movies, and I don't have to.
They're great. I know, right? They're great American films.
Almost have that movie memorized.
I know, but you know, you are making an impact, and I don't know. It just it's hard because this week I've been struggling a little bit because even with this podcast, like, I don't get paid for this, and this week I was like, I've had two. You're the second one I've recorded this week, and I just, at the beginning of the week, I'm just like, oh God. It's the first time I just felt like I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
But then, like, I did the one Wednesday, and I'm like, oh, I'm so happy I did that. And then Anthony Bourdain killed himself, and I was kind of like, it just affected me a little bit for some reason. I'm not usually affected by celebrity death, but
yeah,
that one just got me a little bit because I think as an adult male, I looked at him as an adult role model, like male role model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's super flawed, but he admitted it, and he's like made corrective steps. And just the way he just doesn't, he's just like, I don't care. I just do my thing.
Yeah.
Like, I liked it. But then I got on Twitter and was showing these threads of people just like, yeah, people just need a place to share about different things.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay. And then my buddy just texted me today about, he had already been on, but he listened to another podcast that I did, and he's like, oh man, that one really resonated with me. It was really important to some of the demons I'm battling. I'm like, okay, I needed to hear that. So, and then, you know, like, you show up and give me a hug.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, we're back into it. So, I mean, I think the self-doubt, like, I don't know where this is going to go if there's an outcome, but the process feels good.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
I mean, I think you got to have a certain level of self-doubt to drive you forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you have no self-doubt, you know, we're kind of back to that whole false self-esteem thing that we're giving kids, you know, that nothing bad can happen to me, or, you know, nothing bad could come out of what I'm doing. And when something bad does come out of it, then, you know, you fall apart.
Yeah.
I mean, when we had, you know, I had a conversation with my wife recently. We started doing a thing where I call it our 15-minute check-in. That it's an exercise that we do almost every night that we can. The kids joke, it's like, yeah, you call it 15 minutes, but it usually ends up being like 45 minutes to an hour. But we just kind of, you know, sit on a living room couch,
yeah,
have a, you know, glass of beer or wine, and, you know, just talk about what's going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had, you know, different conversation. I'm trying to remember now where I'm going with this, but where am I going with this? What were we talking about there for a second?
We were talking about self-doubt.
Oh, yeah, self-doubt. And, you know, we talked about my business that I had a number of years ago. I had 2 years, I had a sports performance training center. I think it was probably after you had graduated. Mm-hmm. But it didn't take long for it to fail.
Yeah.
And it was a struggle. And, you know, we went through it. It was, I wouldn't say a strain on our relationship, but it certainly, it was an overload on our relationship, but we grew from it.
The monetary.
Monetary, but even just,
just the stress too.
Just the stress of, you know, the financial burden that it was causing. And my wife is somebody who is much more focused on, you know, that security in the future. Yeah. And I'm much more of a person of faith that, you know, it's going to be fine. Things are going to be taken care of, and, you know, we'll worry about things when they happen. And, you know, she was talking about how, you know, it was a tough thing to go through, but we had to go through it.
Right.
And it was something that I needed to do you know, and there was some purpose behind it. And I think we both realized that, sure. Yeah, it wasn't a perfect thing, but we've recovered from it and lessons were learned from it. And there's
probably
something
stronger now.
Yeah. And there's something in the future that required that happen.
Sure. I like that.
Yeah.
And, which that's hard to have faith in.
Yeah.
You're like, well, I guess this is going to come in handy later. Yeah. Should.
I mean, you got to think that
yeah.
way. And if you look back over your lives, that's, you know, you are where you are because of the shit, good or bad, that happened to you, you know?
You start going back and looking at all the steps that you got here. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah, but change one of them and you're somewhere else.
Somewhere else. Yeah. It's crazy to think about.
Yep.
That's interesting. Yeah. You mentioned that little opposition between you and your wife with the money thing. Mm-hmm. We just talked about that earlier, how that can actually create a much stronger relationship.
Yeah.
That's interesting that you saw that.
It comes down to what you do with it.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the biggest problems in any relationship is a lack of communication.
Well, yeah, I don't think you already told me that you intentionally went to counseling, like couples counseling, right?
Yeah.
That's what you said. And you also schedule time to like sit down just for 15 minutes to actually talk about things.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's pretty rare for a guy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not married. I've never been married, but it sounds like it's pretty rare,
yeah.
but needed.
Well, she thought it was a checkbox thing for me at first.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had done this Fundamentals of High Performance workshop with a gentleman named Coit Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually interesting. It was, I forget how many weeks we did it, but everybody was on the East Coast. I was on the West Coast, and it was 7:30 East Coast time. So I had to get up like 3:30, be on this webcast, and you know, just kind of sit there and chat with these guys. And everybody but one had been a former wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was the lowest level wrestler, having just wrestled high school. These other guys, there was one Olympian, there was guys that are, you know, collegiate coaches and all Americans. And then there was this one woman who was a realtor in Florida. But, I just went through a bunch of different steps and scheduling your day and goal setting and doing all the things that you need to do to be kind of proactive in growth.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought it was just one of those steps.
You know, you're checking me out.
And I'm like, no, it's something I want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've continued to do it. We've been doing it probably at least a year and a half now.
Mm. So, was it hard for you to get into it first, or was it?
Not really.
You kind of made the decision you wanted to do it, I guess, so.
Yeah, because we struggle. I mean, it's with the kids and sports and school and, you know, my commute and her work. It's really hard sometimes to
find time.
Find time to have date nights and do all those kind of things. And
actually talk to each other. Like,
so this is just an opportunity to just stop. Take a breath and communicate.
Mm.
And
did your, I guess when your parents were together, did they communicate a lot? I mean, you said that they obviously didn't, the divorce was a little messy, so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have those memories of them sitting down and doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, I do remember for many years them going off and doing stuff. I mean, they seemed to go on vacations together and things like that, so. Knowing my parent, I would think there was some certain level of communication there, but I know also that there were certain levels of conversation that were kept away, I think that's probably usually the case in any relationship that fails, is it's the things that you don't talk about that continue to divide you and you don't deal with them. So,
And, with your parents too, did you tend to be a little more, it sounded like you're pretty close with your dad.
Yeah.
So it must've been even more confusing when your mom was like, you're just like your dad.
Yeah.
And so what was your relationship like with your mom then?
It was rough for a while. You know, once they divorced and I'm sure much more of it was on me than her, but we butted heads a lot. You know, it was an easy escape for me just to kind of go off with friends, right? At sports and stuff like that. So, you know, we'd have conflict. And I had a younger sister. I still have a younger sister, but I had my younger sister at the time. And, you know, my mom, and I was always raised, you know, you don't hit your sisters or any of that kind of stuff. And my sister and I would butt heads over things. And, you know, it's just different stuff that my mom would seem to kind of more take her side. Yeah. But
she was there. But your mom was there.
Yeah, my mom was there.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, it was up and down. I would say really overall it was probably much better than, you know, I would have thought. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, probably a typical of teenage and son relationship.
Sure.
And, you know, I think one striking remembrance I have just before my parents divorced, my dad was sleeping on the couch at the time, you know, and divorce was inevitable. Mm-hmm. But I, in the morning going off to school, it was winter time, and I smarted off to my mom before school. And after school, I went out with a bunch of buddies. I can't remember if we had taken the trays from the cafeteria and were sledding or if we just got cardboard boxes, but we, you know, we're sledding down this one hill for a while, and I come home, so my butt's frozen.
Yeah.
And my dad is just like, you know, you do not disrespect your mother and this and that. And
oh.
Yeah. I got a nice little spank on his behind. Or that cold butt. It hurt like,
oh my God.
Stung. But, you know, I think, you know, looking back at that, it's like he could have easily said, screw it.
Yeah.
I hate this.
Sleeping
woman.
On the couch at the point. Yeah.
So, but it was that lesson, you know, no matter what I feel about your mother, you don't.
You still had a structure
right.
in place that was keeping you in check.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think my mom and I think a lot of, and again, in hindsight, looking back, I don't fault her for any of the battles that we had because, you know, her saying, I'm just like my father, there were many layers to that.
To that, right.
You know, and it's, I think, physically, I look very, I always joke, I have the same facial disfigurements as my dad. We look a lot, very much alike.
Yeah.
In fact, my son just pointed out recently, there's a picture on our landing of my dad and his wife. And I had to look back at the date and it's like, okay, he's probably just a little bit younger in that picture than I am.
You're like, oh.
And he just pointed out, I think it was my son or my daughter, just pointed out how much we look alike.
Yeah.
And I think to my son, I said, hey, well, that's... So it's going to happen to you. You're going to look like
you'll
this
be
one
here,
day.
Buddy.
And
sorry about that.
You know, so we're very similar in just appearance and all that kind of stuff. And I know that it had to be a reminder for my mom every day that. And so that was probably you know, a hard thing for her.
Yeah.
And it just over time escalated. And then I went off to college and, you know, you come back from college and, you know, you want to do your own thing. And I think, I'm sure I was more disrespectful and all that kind of stuff. And she finally, it was like Thanksgiving, my freshman year in college, she basically just kicked me out. And I didn't really have any conversation with her for about 6 years.
Oh, wow.
And I just kind of got to a point, you know, I was going to a church that was a Sabbath keeping church at the time. Whole long story with that, my cult days, but
your cult days. Yeah.
And you know, so I was going toward, I was like being counseling for baptism and all that with that, and you know, 6 years almost to the day, I, you know, finally decided I need to decided, you know, I can't go on and pursue my beliefs spiritually without reconciling with my mother. Yeah. And so I reached out to her and I'm like, hey, you know, I know we have our differences and I apologize for all that I've ever done. And, you know, if you don't want to have anything to do with me, I'm fine with it. But, you know, if you do, you know, let's try and heal this.
Yeah.
We ended up, I had Thanksgiving with her that year. I mean, like 6 years to the day, you know, that, you know, we were separated and then come together. And it just, it kind of struck me as this, you know, it's just, you know, 6 days and a Sabbath.
A little synergy
like,
there.
Okay, yeah, there's something cosmic happening here.
Yeah, there's something. I'm just going to embrace
and,
it.
And, you know, from that point on, I mean, it's not been perfect, but, you know.
Yeah. How did that first dinner feel?
You know, it felt fine. I mean, it was kind of healing, you know, it was just.
I don't know. I guess I should ask. Did you ever feel like you were missing like a mother figure growing up, like a strong mother energy or figure?
No, not at all. Growing up, because I mean, she was there through you know, all those younger formidable years, and it wasn't really until, you know, I hit the teen years where you naturally want to move away from your parents that
you want to rebel and release a little bit.
I started kind of separating, and then once I was in college, it's like I didn't really need per se that mother figure. In fact, you know, and even in college. Yeah, I probably drifted a little bit more away from my dad as well. Oh, okay. And there are times back and forth, but you know, I've had my ups and downs with both of them.
Sure.
But, you know, now looking back, it's like I have no fault with anything my parents have done, because again, it's I'm who I am because
of those struggles, you know,
good or bad. It's made me who I am. So
I'm looking back at a lot of that now too. And I was raised, my dad raised me. So mom had some problems, but she was just always kind of like in and out. Probably heard that a little bit, but in and out. And, didn't really, I always had like strong women figures around me. So I didn't feel like, I guess I missed having a mom per se, but now looking back and some of the things that I deal with now, you know, I go into counseling and she's like, yeah, you should probably look into that. Like explore that a little bit more, because I recently made the decision just not to I just cut my mom out, because it was like I knew I was never going to develop a relationship with her, and honestly, like, it was just more of felt more like a burden. And it's just like there's no trust there that she can be on the straight and narrow. So I'm just like, I love you, but sorry. But like now realizing, my counselor is like, yeah, you should probably look into the whole mom thing, because you were kind of missing a mom growing up. I'm like, what does that mean? She's like, oh my God. You know, so now, you know, I buy this book and I'll start reading this book. But I just have never really, I'd never really considered it, I guess, because the person, my mom, that my biological, that person, I didn't really ever connect with. So, but missing the mother energy, the mother figure seems to, you know, make me who I am now, but also leave me a little short in some areas. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I guess I never had that. You know? And I think we all have those different relationships, whether the mother's there or not there.
Sure.
I mean, I know, you know, my wife Pam deals with the stuff. It's just, I mean, mother was all around, always around, but, you know, just different issues that she's had with her mother that continue. I mean, to this day, she leaves all her clothes inside out, because when she was younger, her mother refused to, you know, like, I don't know if she would refuse to fold her laundry or just wouldn't fold it. If the clothes were inside out, she left them inside out when she folded them. And my wife's like, well, screw it.
I'm not going to do it either.
I like putting them on this way. So she just left it that way, and she's still to this day just, and I'm sure it's more of a rebellion against her mother, but
That's super interesting. Super interesting how some of those things hold over. I don't know what I have to really think about if any of those things hold over for me. I'm sure there is, but I'm sure other people are screaming at the podcast right now that know me. They're like, yeah, you do this, you've done it forever. It's super interesting. With my dad, we were always close growing up. He was a runner, coach, blah, blah, blah. And, when I went to community college, it was like that male, like I just got pissed at him.
Yeah.
Why? I don't know. Just got super pissed and kind of like didn't talk to him for like a couple months. And then eventually we came back around and then we were best friends.
I think, that happens with everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened with me and my dad when I got out of my master's program. I moved back kind of in with him and we just kind of butted heads. I went out and bought a car. Thought I should buy a used car, and I bought a new car. And actually, I mean, for me, financially, it was the only way to do it, because you know, the interest was much higher on a used car. There was nothing I could afford, and I can get a brand new one, a nice payment level.
Sure.
And it worked out. But then I ended up moving into, I just kind of rented a room from some guys I was working with to get out, and I never told him I was moving out. I just moved. And it was like a few days, and he's like, you know, what's going on? So, it's just that shit that you do, and then you kind of come back and you heal. I mean, my dad and I have a great relationship now. I try to call every week. Try to call both my parents every Sunday, but makes it difficult sometimes.
It does, and then you get just trying to find time for your own family too.
Yeah,
let alone, I mean, you know, the people you're living with. But, go ahead. Go ahead. Just Sorry. Let's take a little bathroom break. Yeah.
This is fun. How long have we been talking?
90 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with the bathroom thing is kind of funny. I've actually been waiting. I've been waiting to see who the first guy is going to be to leave the door open.
Oh.
While they're peeing.
Oh, while they're peeing?
Oh, yeah.
Has anybody done it yet?
Nope, nobody's done it yet. And it's funny, you know, in like community college and stuff, we would... just shit with the door open, just because we wanted somebody to walk by and just be like, hey.
I'll do it at home. You know,
the stupid things that guys would do, though, around each other.
Yeah, I'll start peeing, and I was like, realizing the door's open. It's like my daughter has a friend over or something like that. Oh,
like, go shit.
Can't do that.
Yeah, probably best to be a little more mindful with that one. That's funny. So I'm curious. It just sounds like you have a really good relationship with your wife.
Yeah, I mean,
you're not going to say no, I guess, right? No. Here. But I mean, observation, what I'm hearing you saying, it's like you guys work on it. There's struggles, but it sounds pretty good. I'm curious, like what within that relationship, whether it be things that she shares or tells you or whatever, makes you feel most like a man?
I knew that question was coming.
Yeah. You had to know it was coming.
And you know, it's funny. I've listened to all seven episodes, got the introduction of your podcast. And I knew that question was coming. And, you know, so I've been kind of thinking about how I would answer that. And, you know, it just occurred to me yesterday as we sat down, you know, she just really opened up about how grateful she's been in terms of, you know, my being kind of patient with her and helping her along with things and helping her to grow and all those types of things. And it just struck me as like, okay, that's one of the things that most makes me feel like a man, that, you know, when my wife recognizes that, you know, I'm there for her, you know, I'm trying to live my life, you know, with her as a priority, and, you know, that, it, you know, I'm being impactive in our relationship, not just kind of along for the ride. And I'd say for the sex, but I got two kids.
Yeah.
So that doesn't happen. But, and then another one would be, you know, as I was again thinking on how I would answer this was, it was about 2 months ago, I guess. I went to a conference in Oklahoma for National Conference on Undergraduate Research. Took two students down there. And I'm rarely away from the kids. And usually Pam travels more than I do. But for whatever reasons, you know, going down there, my daughter just was, you know, when I got down there and I called for the first time, she was just crying. She was like crying almost the whole time I was gone. Mm. And, she's a tough little girl. I mean, she will never like act like, yeah, I love you, Dad. She's not all lovey-dovey.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she's more likely to punch me or something like that. I mean, she's very much a little bit more of a tomboyish kind of girl. But, you know, just going down there and having her, I miss you, Daddy, and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that does it.
Yeah. Like my daughter does love me, you know. And I know that, but it's just, you know, that feeling of being missed when you're gone.
Yeah.
You know, and that's probably what does it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting though how that, I mean, again, like talked about in the last one, is like, that's what it is for you. Those are the things that you must value a lot.
Yeah.
That being that kind of family head or that family, you know, or just being a role model in your family. So when somebody's like, hey, I miss you.
Yeah.
You're like, oh yeah. What I'm kind of out here to accomplish, like, you know.
But it's curious if, you know, what we value makes us feel most like a man, or is it,
oh man,
being a man that makes us value those things?
I don't know. The more I talk to guys, and the more we talk about even the word masculinity, it becomes a little more cloudy, because even that word, I don't know, I'm more just leaning more, and not that I wasn't before, just on team human. Like, we're all human with these animal needs that, you know, we all feel good when we get validation of any kind.
Yeah.
You know, and whether you want to call it your masculine energy or you want to call it your feminine energy, it's up to you. Like, I feel really like a man when I'm running.
Yeah.
That's not going to be for every man. You know, I wouldn't feel so manly when I'm, I don't know, playing T-ball. I don't know. You know, it's just something.
Who would feel manly playing T-ball?
There's got to be some guy out there that maybe there is. But it's just becoming, like, it's just all muddled.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just whatever makes you feel confident about who you are.
I would agree with that as well, with the whole masculine, feminine piece. You know, it's, you know, what difference does it make? I mean, they're basically words.
Yeah.
And
sounds, you know, we make with our mouth.
Certain aspects, you know, a I mean, I think what makes you a man, makes you a woman is the organs that are hanging or not hanging in front of you. You know, whether you can pee sitting up or standing down.
Sure.
Sitting up or standing down. Standing up or sitting down.
Right.
So the masculinity piece is, you know, every guy is different. And I think, you know, that's part of what really creates some of the problems we have in society with gender identity is this idea that I'm supposed to be a certain thing and I don't feel that. And so therefore I must be, you know, there's something wrong with me. I'm something else.
Yeah.
You
know? And I definitely never related to the macho bro culture at all. I just wanted to go do my own thing.
Yeah.
Just kind of aloof and was like, oh, okay, whatever.
I mean, I probably fall somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
You know,
you have a good balance. Though,
I think that's part of growing up with my dad and my family that I had.
Yeah, and I was thinking a little bit about this before you came in. You're like, kind of like the wrestling, in, for lack of a better phrase, like tough guy. Uh-huh. But not in like the toxic way, like just be tough, just toughen up. No, not that way. Just like tough, like, hey, let's grind this out type of guy.
Yeah.
But also you have like this nurturing father, teacher, self.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a good balance.
And not sure where exactly that came. You know, I think part of it is having had three sisters growing up.
Oh, man.
You know, part of it is, you know, I mean, when Liam was born, my oldest, we went with cloth diapers. You know, we were a bit more environmentally conscious as we were starting out. And then we realized kind of the diaper service was not the way to go, especially once my wife went back to work. And, you know, you get into daycare and they don't really like the cloth diapers. But we found some other options that were much more environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
But she didn't know how to put on a cloth diaper. Mm-hmm. I had to teach her. It's like, what's wrong with this picture? I'm the male here and I know how to put a cloth diaper on a kid and you don't.
Yeah.
So, and part of that is, you know, growing up, my sister's babysitting. I mean, that's what people used were cloth diapers back then. And I don't even know if I actually put them on, but I, you know, observed. I knew how to do it. And, you know, I had to do the dishes. I had to do house cleaning.
Yeah,
I had to do laundry and do all this other stuff. Well, you had to because it was just
single dad.
But, you know, I always felt like there was men's work and women's work, but I had to do both.
Right, right.
And, you know, because I mowed the lawn. My sisters didn't do that. I took the trash out once a week. And they will tell you, and they'll probably, if they listen to this, they'll argue with me, but they'll tell you that I was spoiled and, you know, I was the favored because I was a male. And I look back and it's like, how was I favored when I had to do all the same chores you did?
Yeah, plus yeah.
You know, but I appreciate it. I mean, I know how to sew. You know, I could do the kind of more stereotypical feminine things, but, you know.
You're just more contributing.
Right. Yeah, I contribute to society.
Yeah,
more
exactly.
Than anybody else.
More than anybody else. Yeah, yeah. Sounds like they beat you into submission a little bit. They kept you in check. They kept you respectful of women.
Yeah, I don't know if that was necessarily beaten in or what. Yeah, but, I mean, it was definitely ingrained
psychologically.
I mean, I dated a girl once that we were walking around and when I crossed the street. And, you know, I'd shift to where I was on the street side. And she's like, would you stop doing that? I'm like, doing what? She's like, every time we cross the street, you got to get on the other side. And it's like, I didn't realize I was doing that. But why should I not be doing that?
You know, my dad used to do that.
Yeah.
He used to always walk on the street side with his lady. And
it's what we're supposed to do. You know, and it's not that, you know, women are lesser than us.
Yeah.
It's,
and that's where I think it starts to go too far, where it's just like, we're just trying to be nice. Yeah. Like, we're trying to be gentlemen. Yeah. But, like, you know, they're like, I don't think feminism is the death of men.
No.
It shouldn't. I don't know why it's seen as that. Yeah. It's like, great. Like, let's, we want you to be who you want to be. But, like, we feel good doing this, and it's not hurting anybody.
Well, I know when Pam and I first really started dating, got married, I had to, tell her, you need to wait. Let me get the door for you in the car.
Yeah.
And it's not that you can't open the car door. It's my way of showing you I respect you and honor you. And, you know, it took her a while, but we've gotten to the point now where if she opens the door and gets in the car by herself, Sometimes she does it just kind of out of speed.
Yeah.
But there are times when she does it, I know she's pissed off at me.
Right.
And so it's always a joke. It's like, what'd they do to piss you off? Nothing. I was just in a hurry.
Yeah.
But then in other times, you know, it's like, okay, I know I fucked up here.
Right. Oops. There's always that thing. I was talking about this with somebody else. instead of with women, I try to say, if they're like unloading a bus, I'll go, oh, what can I grab? Instead of, what can I grab for you?
Okay.
There's that little subtle difference where it's like, it doesn't diminish them.
Yeah.
If you're like, oh, and you need help. You need help because you're a woman. No, it's just like, hey, I want to help. Let me help. So it's just like, I'll just take you out of the equation. What can I grab?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you're saying the same thing.
I'm saying the same thing.
You're just avoiding them feeling insensitive or sensitive about it.
Yeah. So. It's important because I don't think men do that a lot, though.
Yeah.
We just blurt things out sometimes.
Yeah. I'm old school. I mean, I'm 55. I'm used to saying stuff that I
say. And from that East Coast, just blurt it out.
I say stuff in class all the time that I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend anybody. I don't know how much I revealed in classes you had with me, but I do have a tendency to.
I remember you being pretty honest, but I always liked it, so it wasn't. I mean, I'm sure there was other people that were like, what is this guy doing? But
yeah, I always feel like a student's like, would you just shut up about your kids or your wife or your,
it makes it more relatable.
Wrestling days.
They need to relax. those people. Those people need to relax.
I had a student the other day tell me how he enjoyed the story I told about the girl that got sick. And I got a couple of stories about that. There's one when I talk about the medulla oblongata in anatomy that Liam was just an infant. And just as I was talking about it being the vomiting center of the brain, he just projectile vomited.
Oh my
and had
God.
I not turned, he would have puked all over this one girl. But I guarantee to this day, the students in that class know what the medulla does. But I was telling students about a date I had, obviously before I met Pam and got married. But first date. Date went well and everything, and I went to kiss her goodbye, and she got nauseous.
Oh no!
And I was like, "Yeah, it's embarrassing."
Oh,
like,
yeah, well, man.
Really, I'm gonna make you throw up here? Am I that bad?
I'm like, okay.
And here she just had this, you know, the vagus valga thing going, and ended up having to, you know. So I used that to kind of lead into the balance between the parasympathetic nervous systems, but. Yeah, that story obviously stuck with them. But it's like, why do I tell these stories? I mean, I blurred them out, and I'm like, why did I tell you guys that?
Yeah,
I reveal way too much about my personal life.
Keeps it interesting. Yeah, people.
And I think it ingrains in their head a little bit more the lesson I'm
trying
to
teach. Makes it more real.
Yeah.
It's more applicable. But, oh, man, speaking of dating, what would you guys have thought about these dating apps back in the day?
I don't know. You know, I met Pam through Match.com. So,
okay. You're like a first adopter.
I guess. You know, yeah. So we've been married, 14 years now.
Yeah.
And
because how did you feel about using Match at the time? Because that was, you said 14 years ago?
Yeah, it was 14 years ago.
Yeah.
So I was teaching at Eastern Michigan. And, you know, as a college professor, and I was relatively young at the time, I mean, I was probably only about 15 years older than some of the students I had. And, you know, grad students, it was even closer. But you can't date your students, you know, and the only contact you're having with women are either your students or secretaries or other faculty. And it's so hard to go out and just meet people.
Yeah.
And this is the age where, you know, I don't want to go out clubbing and you know, I'm not going to meet anybody, you know, at a club.
Yeah.
You know, somebody that I really want to have a relationship with. And I wasn't meeting anybody at church or any of that kind of stuff. So. A buddy of mine really pushed me to just try Match.com, and yeah, I went on, and I went on a number of different dates with it, some good, some bad. But Pam was in, I was living in Ypsilanti, Michigan. She was in Alexandria, Virginia. Mm-hmm. My dad had, he and his wife had just moved down there, and she was being offered a promotion with the company she was working for to move to Southwest Michigan. And she just got on to Match.com to prove that there were no eligible guys. And she was trying to find every excuse not to take this promotion. And she came across my profile and she says that my, you know, smile and my profile kind of caught her attention and she kind of liked it. And for some reason it was just, it was in her head for a couple of days and she just never responded to it. And finally just kind of decided, yeah, I'm just going to send him a note saying, you know, I liked his profile and I think he has a great smile. And so she sends me a note and says, you know, too bad we'll never meet, you know, but, and I wrote back, I said, well, you never know. My dad just moved, you know, to Arlington, Virginia. So,
yeah.
And it just turns out that he was like 5 minutes from where she lived.
Oh.
And so that was enough to get us talking. Yeah. And then we started, you know, emailing back and forth and then started calling and I got my first cell phone. So, you know, it was easier to kind of call her. And it's amazing that, you know, that's what prompted me to get a cell phone. And now it's like, I can't do it that way.
Yeah, right.
And then I went down in August just before the semester started and we went out on our first date. Just had dinner and really hit it off. Had a great time.
Wow.
I was supposed to have dinner with my dad and his wife the next day, and she wanted to see me again. And so I invite her to dinner with my dad. I mean, like second date.
Already with the dad.
And with my dad. Not just any dad, my dad. And so she comes to dinner with us, and that night my dad's like, she's a keeper. Don't fuck this up.
Like, no pressure.
And Friday we had a date planned to just go cycling because she figured if I don't like this guy, I can always just outbike him. You know, I could bike with anybody. And so we did that and we just had a really great time. And then we ended up that next day I was scheduled to do a kayaking trip on Chesapeake with my sister. And, you know, I don't think I could even have had her join it, but I didn't think to invite her to do that. And she canceled a similar event that she was supposed to go to with a bunch of singles because we hit it off so well. Yeah. She didn't go on this thing. And then Sunday, you know, so the fourth of the five days that I was in Virginia, we went kayaking on the Potomac and we just hit it off. And so, you know, we had 4 dates in 5 days and just started, you know, communicating back and forth. And by October, you know, it's kind of, we were out in a mall or something like that. And it was just kind of, I forget how I phrased it, but I just kind of directed her towards the wedding rings and got that discussion going. Geez. And, you know, we just started talking about getting married. And by Thanksgiving, you know, we were already planning the wedding.
That escalated quickly.
Yeah. We couldn't really tell anybody about it so much.
Yeah.
Because I had to meet her parents yet.
Oh my God.
And so, my dad knew, and it's something all came up at Thanksgiving. They had company over and I said something and my dad said, oh, so we can talk about it now?
Yeah.
Here, he had been telling everybody, I told all my aunts and everybody that I was engaged.
Oh my God.
I was like, okay, thanks, Dad.
Yeah.
And then I was with Pam's family at Christmas time and she's got a much more reserved family than I do. They don't talk about things the way my family would. And, you know, my family will fight. And there's always some battle going on, but push comes to shove. I mean, it's a very close family. And her family, they just don't communicate those emotions as much.
Yeah.
And I hadn't met her parents yet. So, you know, me being the traditional male that I am, I wanted to get her dad's, you know, permission to ask her for my hand for marriage. And, you know, so we weren't officially engaged yet. We'd already bought the ring and done all that kind of stuff. And she picked out the ring and I had it with me, and I couldn't quite find that opportunity to just kind of get her dad aside. It's like, how do you just met this guy. How do you, you know, pull him aside and say, you know, I'd like your daughter's hand in marriage.
Hey, and I'm Jeff.
So I waited until they exchanged all their gifts, and then I had already reached in my pocket. I had the ring in my hand.
Which is a smart move because they're happy at that point.
Yeah.
They just got the gifts. Got him in a good place.
Right. And I knew she was going to say yes, so it was no problem. But so I say, well, I have one more gift for Pam. And I start getting down on my knee. And it was like in my mind, I'm hearing it in slow motion. Like, it's a no, not now. And I get down and I say, with your father's permission, I'd like to ask your hand in marriage. And silence. he doesn't say a word. And I'm like, well, do I have your permission or not? And he said, well, yeah, of course you do. I just was waiting to hear what Pam had to say or whatever. Thanks for the scare.
Yes, thanks for the horrible scare of silence.
So, you know, we got engaged there, and she's just like, she could not believe I did that, because you don't do that stuff in her family.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, well, good. Where else was I going to do it?
Good start. Yeah.
So it just kind of set the pace, and I think it really scored big points for, you know, me with her dad.
Yeah.
That, you know, I was willing to ask for his permission, and I think...
In front of everybody,
yeah,
probably.
Because she was married before, and it was not... Yeah, happy ending. He cheated on her and stuff like that. Geez. And so we dealt for years with her trying to overcome some of those distrusts.
Trust. Yeah.
You know, to realize that, you know, she can trust me. And it's great to know that she has.
Well, now you know you got somebody that's bought in, right?
Yeah.
Somebody goes through that if you can earn their trust.
Yeah.
All that from Match.
Yeah, all that from Match.com, and all that from a question about dating.
So great. It was so, yeah. there's a lot of interesting stuff in there too. Like, you know, you mentioned as a kind of a traditional guy, She's the one who messaged you first or kind of initiated, right?
Yeah.
How did you take that sort of thing?
I took it well. I mean,
I personally don't understand the attitude that guys need to message first or make the first move.
So
I don't think guys are that complicated.
No,
they're like, oh, if you like us, just say something.
Yeah,
I don't know, for me at least.
Yeah, but. I was fine with it. I probably would have been fine if she'd asked me out, because you know, pretty apprehensive. I'm still stiff around women, but you know, back to the question about the dating apps. I mean, I like those Match.com ones, and there's countless other ones now, but
there's some longer form ones when you can get to know the person a little bit, well, as much as you can by reading.
Right. And it's a lot easier to kind of have that initial screening rather than, you know, being somewhere and looking across the room, and it almost entirely have to be based on looks.
Yeah.
You know, nothing about their personality, you know, nothing about this person. And unless you're going to meet them in a situation where either somebody's introducing you, and I went that whole route with people trying to
set up,
fix me up.
Yeah.
And those never went
I've never gone fix up.
Yeah. But, you know, you go out on a date, and, you know, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. It's not like now it's somebody at work that you got to now see all the time.
Right.
I just had this crappy date with this person.
Right.
Or, you know, a friend that, you know, goes out of their way to introduce you to somebody, and then you just really bungle the date.
Yeah, I mean, I've met some... Well, the only thing with the apps is it can be a little bit like window shopping.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, and then what's represented on the profile after you meet them, you're like...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shit.
It's like buying things through those Facebook ads.
Yeah. You get the product, and you're like, wait a minute. Yeah. The thing is, like, yeah, you're not, like, you don't have to see them socially again. Like, I've had some train wreck ones where, I don't know if you heard, but it was like... I went out with this lady a few times, and she was younger than me. She's 26 or something, but she ended up, she'd been married for 7 years.
Oh, you just talked about that on the sixth episode.
Yeah. But she'd been married for 7 years and then had a relationship, or like this pseudo relationship for a year after, and had only been single for like a month.
Wow.
And I learned about this, and then she starts crying, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
These dating apps.
But, you know, you could have had the same thing if you had just met her
at
work or something like that. So I think it just kind of helps to cut out some of the BS and, you know, put you in a situation to maybe find somebody you're more compatible with, at least from the start. Or at least not having to put on too many airs or try and probe enough to figure out, you know, what's this person into.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm good with it. Not so sure I would go for any of the Tinder or some of those kind of things. Which, what is it? Swipe to the right.
Swipe. Yeah,
that's just completely you know, superficial. I think
it is.
Right. It worked for me. So
yeah, you're giving me hope.
Yeah,
you're giving me hope.
It's always hope.
And that's interesting.
Well, you're 30 now, right?
Yeah, I'll be 31 tomorrow.
31. Happy birthday.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. So I met Pam when I was probably 40.
Yeah.
Yeah, so okay. I was really, really slow.
Yeah.
I was socially retarded, I think.
Well, oh my God.
Really, really slow.
Think back to your early 20s. Can you imagine being married?
Oh no.
Oh my God.
No, there is no way.
Oh my God. I'm looking back and I'm like, oh my God, thank you.
In fact, my parents got married at 19. I don't know how they did it.
Oh, my grandparents, I think both sets got married super young, before 20. And then they're just married for 70 years. I'm just like, what the...
I don't think that the current generations have the level of maturity to do that.
No, well, they don't even talk to each other. No. Don't talk to humans. Like, so, I don't know. And then, two, for guys, what, our brains don't even stop developing until we're 25?
Right.
I mean, it's just like we're animals.
I think from experience, I think 30 seems to be kind of a ripe age for guys to get.
Yeah.
You know, to begin to think about getting married. You know, you've had time to kind of get established a little bit career-wise or get your life together. You know what you want, what you don't want.
At 30, I love 30.
Yeah.
30, these years, because I'd know myself more so than any other day. Yeah. Ever.
And I think it was about 30 where I felt ready to start pursuing, you know, a lasting relationship.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
The right barriers were there to keep me from the wrong ones until I met Tams.
Right. Right. You have ups and downs along the way. And all right. So I got the What Women Wonder questions for you.
Uh-oh.
So these are actually, these will go pretty well, I think, here, the ones I chose. So, this one, actually, I'm interested to hear what you say, because growing up with women, and you tell me the things you did, maybe you won't have an answer, but are there any things / activities in your life that you feel compelled to pretend to enjoy more than you do? Could be within sports, or could be anything.
I don't think so. I don't know. I just tend to be pretty honest with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and maybe that's why, you know, I didn't end up getting married until I was 40, that I wasn't as willing to kind of pretend.
Sure.
You know, my wife knows I hate dancing. You know, I don't know if there's anything
even growing up, was there anything when you were a young pup?
I honestly, I can't think of anything that I would do that I didn't enjoy doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I would.
I'm probably not giving you an exciting answer.
No. I think it's important to understand, though, that there's not, like, it's not every guy doesn't feel, just because we feel compelled to do something or somebody else is doing it, doesn't mean we're going to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is some peer pressure stuff that happens, but, you know, like some of the locker room talk, too, like I said, I shied away from it a lot. I mean, but you're kind of like, it's still your community of guys over there talking, and sometimes you're like, oh, maybe I should just go over there and see what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I've participated in that stuff, I'm sure peer example and peer pressure kind of drove me to do that, but I can't say that, you know, I wasn't complicit in doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't feel like it was something that I did that I didn't like doing.
Sure.
You know, it was just the darker side of me that I needed to learn to to get rid of.
Yeah. The other one, I guess, for me at least, was always drinking.
Yeah. See, drinking, I had no problem with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was always observationally, mom was a drinker, grandfather was an alcoholic, so I just always shied away from it.
Yeah.
But there was always a pressure to do it. And it kind of felt like...
My parents were not big drinkers. They still aren't. Yeah. I mean, I remember the first time, and probably only time I ever saw my mom drunk. She came home from, she was in a parents without partners social group kind of thing, and went to a party. We used to call it parents without potential, but that wasn't very nice. But she came home and she's just a little tipsy, and I just had to give her a hard time. Like, hey, Mom, you're drunk. But, you know, my dad, I don't think I've ever seen my dad drunk.
No.
I never seen him drink more than a beer or two. Just never
an issue,
way, you know,
but never felt the pressure to do it.
Alcohol was fine, you know, and they never really pressured me against drinking, or it was never a big taboo thing. In fact, as a kid, I remember holidays, you know, I'd always get to have a little glass of cold duck, you know, crappy wine, but you know, it was okay to have a little bit of it. And you kind of understood that, you know, alcohol is okay in the right situations. When I was in high school, I don't think my dad ever, you know, was naive enough to think I wouldn't be out drinking. Yeah. It was always, you know, you don't drink and drive and you don't drink in my car.
Sure.
And other than that, there were no other rules.
Well, he kind of takes the power from it.
Yeah.
It takes the ooh, what is this? Yeah. That wonder away from it. And then you just know there's rules and you know there's like certain times you can use it and not.
Yeah.
And then you're just like, all right, well, I don't need to, it's like whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a big difference with European kids too. It's just like, it's part of their culture. It's not a big deal.
That's why they have a much lower incidence of alcoholism.
Yeah.
In cultures like that.
Yeah, because they practice.
Yeah. but yeah, I remember my first real social beer was the end of eighth grade.
Wow.
Yeah.
A full beer.
Two full beers.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it was two full. We went over to, we had our eighth grade picnic after, you know, like the last week of school. And it was a nearby park, and it was my friend Jim and a couple other guys just kind of darted out, went to Jim's house, and, you know, he pulled out a couple of his dad's Heinekens, and, you know, we had a couple beers and kind of went back to the party.
No big deal.
No, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
You know? Nobody really got hammered.
How big were you then?
I had to be kind of... I was heavier than my son, but probably about the same height. So I was probably about 5'11", you know, starting to push 6 foot, probably weighing about 170 pounds at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back in eighth grade, if I had drank two beers, I would have probably been passed out. It's just so small, you know?
Yeah. I don't know, we were a little drunker than we thought. But,
yeah.
But yeah, we did that. And then through high school, I mean, it was pretty frequent, but never...
There was never it doesn't sound like there was ever a pressure around it, though, ever, for you.
Yeah, it was always kind of a more mutual pressure. I mean, we wanted to do it, and I don't think we ever forced any friends to drink.
Sure.
You know, it was never like, oh, you wuss, you know, why don't you drink? And just, we'd have parties, friends would clean up, and, you know, we'd drink a little bit. My one friend, Bernie, I was always kind of our designated driver, so he enjoyed that yeah. He would drink too, but never, you know, enough to get so impaired he couldn't drive us home. And there were times, I mean, I remember there were a couple times when we got in the car, we never should have gotten in the car.
Yeah.
But
we
made it home.
Made it good. Yeah, that's a tough one though. Not wanting to drink and then drinking can lead to some bad places.
Yeah.
So there's dangerous places too, but.
And it's different now. I mean, kids, you know, are a little less responsible with one another. You got to be careful with whom you're drinking and what you're drinking.
What you're drinking.
Date drugs and all that kind of stuff.
On a positive note, we do have things like Lyft and Uber.
Yeah.
To get people home safely.
Yeah.
So that's good.
And my kids will always know that they can call me.
Yeah.
I would much rather them call me and be just... shit-faced drunk and, they'll pay for it the next day.
Pay for
it's
it the
like
next
I gotta
day,
punish
but,
them, but
don't be pissed in a moment and just go get them home safely.
And, you know, if they call me, I'm not going to be upset. If, you know, I find out that they drove drunk,
be pissed.
Or they got in a car with somebody drunk, then I will be pissed.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, go have fun.
Yeah.
I'm not going to stop you.
Yeah.
It probably makes me, again, a bad parent.
No, I think you're allowing them to... you know, take a measured risk. I'm sure you've talked about it, but it's like, hey, you know, go learn.
Yeah. But the rules are a lot different now than they were when I was a kid. You know, now, you know, they're willing to arrest you for
it's
alcohol
crazy.
And stuff like that. Whereas when we were kids, you know, you have a kegger or something like that and the cops show up, they're just going to take the beer.
Down, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. I don't think that's right. You're like, you can destroy a kid's lives.
Yeah.
Just arrest them, and they always have that on their record forever. And it's just like, you know, not forever maybe, but it's just, I don't know. It's kind of pointless to me.
Of course, I always love, too, that they are quick to give somebody a minor in possession for alcohol, but never for cigarettes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I've never thought about that. Yeah,
I mean, it's like you want to stop people from smoking, then actually arrest these kids that are obviously underage standing on the corner smoking. I mean, you would give them a ticket if they were drinking a beer on the corner.
Maybe.
And they can't legally be smoking.
Maybe that's because smoking, you think that's because smoking, when you smoke a cigarette, you can get in a car,
guess, but yeah.
Maybe that's it. I don't, but maybe not.
But
I'm making things up there, but.
I'm sure that's part of it, and it's just what they've chosen to enforce.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that Oregon just raised the smoking age to 21, big deal. What's that going to do? Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so
I wasn't paying attention.
That's because you're over 21.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if I smoke cigarettes. They're just ridiculous. But, And yeah, it's interesting how we treat teenagers and the mistakes they do make. We should probably lighten up a little bit. But all right, second question here from one of my female listeners. This was kind of a two-parter, but I only took the second part because the first part was unrelated. But so it just says word for word, I am also interested in why men seem so much less proactive in advocating for men issues, rape in prison, circumcision, etc., outside of using these things as counterpoints to feminist arguments and attempting to trip up movements like Me Too. Why don't men advocate as women do?
I don't know that all men don't advocate for it.
Right.
I mean, I do.
Right. I don't know if, well, in this, one of these particular examples that this person shared about circumcision, I don't think I've ever heard another man, well, just because I've heard it on a podcast or two recently, but like in friend groups and in conversations, I've never heard that as like a male issue being like, yeah, that's really messing men up. You know what I mean?
I don't see that circumcision really messes men up.
No, no. So that's, you know, why, I mean,
reasons for it. And
we're not going to advocate for it if we don't see it as a huge problem.
I mean, my son was circumcised. First time I taught anatomy and had to teach the reproductive system, I ended up, you know, my typical form, telling stories. I had to talk about my son's circumcision because we waited.
Your son's going to be horrified about
that. I know. and especially, you know, all those kids saw him and knew him and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But we waited until the eighth day because, you know, partly because, you know, it's that biblical example, but also because I knew that part of the reason why in the Jewish culture they wait that long is because it takes that long before the vitamin K actually is, you know, released in, you know, into the system, and the child can have his own clotting.
Oh, okay.
And so they don't have to give him a shot of vitamin K in order to have him clot and to be able to heal from the circumcision. And we had it done outside the hospital. We were there, you know, we had a physician assistant do it. And, you know, he said, you know, he had like, I think about a 95%, 98%, no cry record. And, you know, Liam didn't cry. There was no pain involved.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quick and easy.
Yeah.
I mean, we got to see it happen. It's like, it's not a necessarily an abusive kind of thing.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of the problems that people might have with it is they don't see it. You know, you go to the hospital, you have a baby, you hand the kid off to a nurse, and the kid comes back with his foreskin gone.
Yeah.
And people just make assumptions that it's that. And it doesn't mean everybody should or needs to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't judge anybody for not circumcising, and I, you know, I don't judge anybody for circumcising. And I just, it's weird. I just remembered, I was trying to remember for the longest time, when I was in seventh or eighth grade, there was this Lebanese kid that moved to our school I was only there for maybe a year, maybe two. But I mean, this was at the height of all these wars and stuff in Lebanon, and he had actually been shot. And just kind of a messed up childhood coming from Lebanon, but a very different culture shock. I mean, I grew up in a very white middle class community. I mean, it was ethnically diverse in terms of Greek, Italian, Polish, and Irish. Diverse white population.
Diverse white people.
And, you know, and a few occasional, you know, Asians thrown in there and stuff like that. But, you know, this kid coming in from Lebanon, very different culture. And I just remember, you know, being in the locker room at gym class, and he's like, "Oh, you're all circumcised, but I'm not." You know, and teenage boy, "What am I doing? What are you doing?"
Yeah,
how dare you look at my
penis? Why are you making that observation out loud?
This guy's freaking out, and you know, just kind of ended up ostracizing him a little bit, not horribly.
Yeah,
but, I remember. Shouldn't say his name now, but I've been like for a while trying to, he keeps popping up occasionally, and it's like, I can't remember his name. I know it was, he had like two name, two repeated names, and his name was like, I think Elias.
Yeah.
So if you're out there listening, you know,
yeah.
Sorry if we made fun of you.
Sorry.
Circumcised, but.
You know, with this particular issue, I don't think it's like this thing dividing men or this thing that's changing our lives in some negative way or causing us to be, not us, causing some men to be like super assholes or anything. So like, I'm not going to get out there and just be like, bang the drum for, you know, why are you getting your kid circumcised? I'm like, do you?
I mean, the kid has, you know, sure the kid has no choice in it.
Yeah.
But the kid also has no real recollection of it either. I mean, talk to any man and ask him, you know, to recall his circumcision.
Sure.
And unless he was circumcised at an advanced age, you know, he converts to Judaism or something like that, and he gets circumcised when he's an adult. And even then, I bet he wouldn't say, oh, it was horrible, painful. You know,
guys,
I was butchered, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might get a bad circumcision or something like that, and you kind of, you know.
Sure. Then you might have some negative, right? But that's more of a personal thing than like other men.
Yeah,
I don't know. She, this person also mentioned rape in prison. You know, obviously men, but
meaning rape in prison?
Prison.
Oh,
why aren't men advocating for cleaning that up? I guess.
God, that's a hard one.
And I think some of that's human, probably.
Probably.
Like, you know, if there's a bunch of murderers in prison, I think just as humans outside, we probably look at those people and like, well, they're monsters.
Yeah.
So like, we have other things that maybe we could advocate for. And I'm not saying that's right, but like, it might just be kind of a natural reaction to people who are in prison.
Yeah, I would say you're right there. I don't think it's something that is male or female. Yeah. I mean, I don't know of many women that are you know, stepping up on a podium with a bullhorn, you know,
and with
protesting men being raped in prison.
Yeah, and to be clear too, there's people in prison who shouldn't be in prison.
True.
So I'm not saying that everybody should be viewed as a monster.
No, but, and I'm not saying anybody should be raped in prison.
Right. Either, no, certainly not.
But I think we just, you know, I think it probably gets accepted by both sides because we're a little less sensitive to individual kind of feelings in prison. I mean,
yeah.
And I guess maybe
the prison
now
system,
I'm feeling guilty, I'm going to have to go and start praying.
I know. Well, the whole prison system's a mess right now.
Oh, it is. And
like, privatized prisons? I mean, that's a whole different podcast. You can talk about privatized prisons and all that.
No.
What that creates. So, I mean, there's definitely other things that I think are being advocated for that might not solve that issue, but definitely like clean it up if you can get the structure of it cleaned up a little bit.
And honestly, I don't know how much rape occurs in prison either. You know, I mean, I've never been there.
It's a good question.
I've never experienced it.
I don't know the data to comment on it. So
it's, you know, it's not something that should happen, but it's also not a cause that many of us are as inclined to just jump onto because we haven't experienced it.
Yeah. Well, and it's not affecting, I mean, I don't support it, but like, it's not affecting society as a whole right now either.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of shit going on right now that's very problematic. But the other thing that she mentioned, though, that here, that's kind of a subtle little thing, that we, outside of using things as counterpoints to feminist arguments and attempting to trip up movements like Me Too.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I can't think of a.
That's not why I don't do any of those things.
Right. I don't see myself as ever advocating for a man to trip something else up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I think, I mean, you look at Facebook, you're going to see both sides doing that. They use their side to try and trip up the other side.
Right.
I mean, you know, on my blog, I just posted, I think it was today or yesterday, I called it, you know, lipstick on a pig.
Yeah. I read that.
I did. Yeah. So talking about the whole, you know, Bill Clinton's refusal to apologize for, you know, everything that happened with Monica Lewinsky and, you know, the left really going to his defense, the right, you know, arguing that, you know, he's such a pig, this and that. And it's like, first of all, the video that was being used, I mean, Fox News did a piece on it, and they completely misrepresented it. They didn't, you know, honestly report what he said. He did not refuse to apologize.
Right.
He said he apologized on air, and as far as I remember, he did. He may not have apologized to her directly, but I'm not even sure that that would be necessarily an appropriate thing. You know, it was also something that it was complicit, although, you know, he did take advantage of his power. It's really a messy kind of issue. But that all aside, they're saying, okay, he's okay, but then the right's saying, no, he's absolutely wrong, and he's a pig, and, you know, he should be accounted for. But then they turn around and, you know, you have a priest or a politician or a pastor or somebody like that does something, and it's like it's the fault of the person who seduced them. You know, it's like...
That's an example.
Somebody made a comment on it about women seducing men. It's like, well, first of all, this whole seduction piece, there's two people in a seduction.
Yeah.
You know, so I can never use the argument, well, she seduced me. It's like, I should be able to resist that.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's a female that doesn't want to be seduced by a male, then it's rape. Sure. And conversely, it's the same thing. But, you know, it's... If a woman does in fact force herself on a man, then it's rape. Yeah. He's not seduced, and that's different than the whole argument we're having here or discussion we're having here. But when we try and, you know, they push the blame onto the woman that, you know, she tempted him and all that kind of stuff, and he's a flawed person, you know, the devil made him do it or whatever. Yeah. It's like, well, how is it okay for this guy because he's on your side, but on the other side it's so wrong, and then from the other side, you know, it's okay here because, you know, he, you know, apologized for whatever he did or whatever. But what about all these guys?
Yeah.
You know, we never say, look, they're all pigs.
Yeah.
You know, in every case, guy should not be forcing himself on a woman. He should not be taking advantage of his power.
Right.
You know, and take responsibility for this stuff.
Well, and you made the good point, too, of it's happening. The counterpoints against these feminist arguments, I guess, are whenever it's like supports your agenda.
Yeah.
Right. Whether or not you said the priest or whatever, or the right, or even the left, when it's just like, well, we're going to excuse that because it supports our agenda.
Right. And it's like the whole Me Too movement.
Yeah.
It's like both sides, there's all kind of crap going on there,
yeah.
But you know, there's the Hollywood side, the liberal side kind of somewhat justifies. I mean, you know, you look at all the pictures of all the different, you know, women who are supposed to be out there leading the Me Too movement with, you know, their picture being taken with Harvey Weinstein.
Sure.
It's like, you know, did you not realize this stuff was going on?
Yeah.
Or, you know, you have NBC, all these people, you know, with Matt Lauer. I mean, come on, you knew this stuff was going on. Did anybody in either side ever, you know, have the balls to, or, you know,
well, and then in that case, I think that's where you need the men to step up, and not saying women are powerless, but even some men though probably felt like, whoa, this guy's way too powerful for me to say anything.
Yeah,
like there when you get so much power that you can just, it's like I'll destroy everybody.
Yeah, but who is that powerful?
Yeah,
I mean, honestly, we give that power to them if we see something going on and we don't stand up. You know,
power is getting taken away now.
And, you know, I would hope that in any of those situations, I would make a stand.
Yeah.
And in some circumstances, I know it's difficult to do something, but you can do something.
Yeah. You can do something.
Know? Or at least, you know, if you can't make the stand, you know, you can get the woman to, you know, encourage her to go do something.
Sure.
You know,
make it feel safe to do it.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of the times I haven't felt safe enough to do it.
Yeah. I've had a few times where I've kind of stepped in, done stuff that may have been pretty stupid.
Really?
And, you know, not necessarily stupid, but I remember one time, buddy Charlie and I were, it was after the American College of Sports Medicine conference in Denver, and we went down to Colorado Springs. We were spending a night in a hotel there, and just we went to the Olympic Training Center, and it's a cheap hotel, so kind of in a more seedier area.
Yeah.
But later in the night, I hear this like woman kind of screaming and getting thrown around in the room next to us, and without thinking, I just go to the door next door, and I start beating on the door, and nobody came to the door or whatever. So I went back in and called the cops. Everybody's like, what are you doing? I could have a gun or whatever. I said, like, well,
yeah,
what am I going to do? Just let her get beat up. And, you know, of course, you know, the cops come and we're kind of watching from our window, and she basically tells the cops, you know, it's a misunderstanding. Nothing happened. And they leave. It's like, seriously,
what? Something going on.
I know. I did my part. There's nothing more I could have done. And, you know, I've had other times with apartments, neighbors where similar things happen and I'll go over. And that's kind of the most I can do.
Yeah.
You know, if I would hope that if I came upon somebody being raped or molested or something, it's like the whole Penn State thing with what's his name?
Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah, Jerry Sandusky, where the one coach went in the locker room and saw him and turned around.
And just turned around and walked out.
And he, apparently, the next day, he went and talked to Joe Paterno.
The next day,
yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I would hope that any male would step in right then, right there. Yeah. I don't care who the person is that is, you know, involved.
That's the lowest level of monster.
Right. You do something.
Yeah.
You know, and the same in a rape situation.
Yeah.
You know, there's no excuse for not doing something right then and right there. You know, even if you are in a weaker position.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sacrifice yourself for the woman to get away or the child to get away.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I don't know. I get pretty worked up. Stuff,
me, you know? Even like, recently too, with all this too, so go out into a setting where it's a lot of guys, girls, like in a club or something. And usually that's not my scene, but if I'm there for a work function or just socially or whatever, I'm usually sober, but everyone else is, you know, progressively drinking more. And then you kind of see some guys start getting a little handsy.
Yeah.
Starting, it's like, well, I know that person has like a boyfriend and that's not the boyfriend. And it's like, do I say something here? As a guy, I don't know what to do sometimes. Yeah. So I've asked people, I'm like, what would you like me to do? Because this is what I observed. And they were like, really? I'm like, well, yeah. But I didn't like know if I should step in and be like, because that can all, people get offended by that too.
Yeah.
They're like, no, you can say something if you want.
Yeah.
Like, that's okay.
I think if you just even just go up to the girl and just act, even if it's somebody you don't know and you feel like she's uncomfortable, you know, just like, hey, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing, you know?
Yeah. That'd be good. I think more guys need to do that.
Yeah.
Not be afraid to do it.
Most guys are not going to engage with you if they're doing something like that.
No.
You know, they're basically doing what they're doing. Yeah. They lack a certain level of manhood anyhow that they have to do that.
Yeah.
And usually, you know, best way to defeat a bully is to challenge them. You never have to really actually fight them. Just give them the sense that,
you know, see you, buddy.
Yeah. You're going to hurt them. I used to do that in New York all the time, that I would get on a bus and I would make the guy that was sitting there all cocky with like taking up two seats, make him move his stuff. I don't know why I had to do this, but I would do it. And one time, I get on there and this guy refused to move his stuff and he starts giving me all kind of lip, and this other guy across the way said, here, you can just sit here. And so I sit down the whole way into, I used to have to take a bus from this grocery store in Elmont, New York to Jamaica, Queens. And I take the subway from there. And so I'm on the bus and this guy is just going on and on about, you know, bad mouthing me and stuff like that. And the guy next to me is like, you know, don't worry about him. And I said, oh, I'm not sweating him. And I said it loud enough for the guy to hear me. I'm like, what are you doing? And it's like, you're getting a fight as soon as you get off this bus. But the guy was the first one off the bus.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, just proves my point.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, just show these people you're not afraid of them. And in the back of their head, they're thinking, okay, there's a reason why this guy's not afraid of me. So sure. I better just back off.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you don't have to engage in them or anything like that. And I would think, in a situation where, like, in a bar or something like that, if a guy starts stepping up, somebody else is going to step in, too. Hope that nobody... Of course, I don't know. You watch
these videos, effect.
All the people that got to have their phones out videotaping.
Yeah, not doing anything.
That stuff gets me so upset because it's like, you know, you're not doing anything, but you're videotaping this, and you're going to post it on the web saying, oh, how terrible, you know, look at this asshole. It's like,
you didn't do anything.
Yeah. You're the asshole, too.
Yeah. Step in and help.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes with guys, too, I think, why don't men activate as women do? Like, for me, like, I can look around at other guys, especially other white guys. I'm like, yeah, we got it pretty easy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm willing to admit that. Like, pretty privileged. I'm not saying, not going super left on that, but like, yeah, privileged white guy. It's like, what am I going to advocate for them?
Yeah.
Like they're getting pretty much anything they want. Like, but if there's somebody taking advantage of somebody else, I think,
yeah,
like you said, I think I'd say something, but cool. Okay. The quick questions I got at the end, and I have a bonus one for you because uh-oh, I know you've already, I know you already know the questions. So if you could travel back in time to visit your 16-year-old self, what would you say?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Yes.
I like it.
I would say absolutely nothing. Because, again, we kind of had to, I almost slipped into that conversation earlier when, yeah, I was talking about how, you know, everything that's happened in my life has happened, you know, whether it's for, you know, a predetermined reason or whatever, but I am where I am now because of all those things happening. And so if I'd go back and, you know, give myself some advice, yeah, you should, you know, go out with that girl, yeah, that you're afraid to go out with, or, you know, I used to think, okay, I got all this knowledge of exercise physiology. What if I could go back into, yeah, the, you know, mid-70s with all this knowledge and, you know, teach myself how to lift
guru
weights,
yeah,
and, you know, increase sports performance training and all this stuff. I'd be like a superstar athlete.
Absolutely.
But that would have changed so many different things.
So many different things.
You know? So I've gotten this question in different formats before, and I think the answer I've always just come to is like, no, I couldn't do anything.
I like it.
You know, it's just do what you're doing. You know, I wouldn't even interact. It's like kind of that whole, you know, if you interact with yourself
observer
in the past,
effect. Yeah.
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 You're going to disrupt
the butterfly
yeah,
effect.
You're going to disrupt so many different things. But, you know, if I think about that, I mean, I change one slight little thing that I've done in the past, you know, it's going to have a rippling effect. Yeah. You know, if you were to date somebody that you didn't date, or, you know, like I was being recruited. The only place that recruited me for football in high school was University of Chicago.
Mm.
That's how bad I was. But I had decided I was going to West Virginia University. I was going to major in mine engineering. They had a great program there, and I was just going to get through school and be done. I had listened to the recruiter. He was like, you know, come to Chicago, you know, you can play football, you get a degree in geology, and it wouldn't be that much to go back and get your mining degree. I'm like, no, you know, I just want to get through school. And what do I end up with, an undergrad degree in geology? And so it's like, well, would that have been better had I done that?
Yeah.
Or somebody recently asked a question about, you know, if you could do it over again, would you start college when you did or whatever? And, you know, it was the same thought. It's like, yeah, I could have sat out my freshman year, lived with one of my sisters in West Virginia, gotten in-state tuition, saved myself some money, probably saved on a lot of student loans.
Mm.
But if I'd done that, then all those relationships, all those friends that I made would not have existed.
Right.
And where would that be today?
Yeah. So, well, I've said the same thing about grad school too. People are like, well, if you do the MBA program, would you do it again? Like, well, educationally, I'm like, I don't know. But like, yes, because I met some amazing people who I still talk with now, and I'm so glad they're in my life.
Yeah.
But like, thinking about your answer now, I wonder how much of that you're just like, I don't think a 30-year-old would think that, you know, a 30-year-old, like, or the younger people I've even had that are a little younger than me would probably go back and be like, yeah, I'd change this and that, because they're still in the midst of like settling into life. but that's a great answer, and it's a great perspective to have too. I like it. If you could live the life of one man, real or fiction, who would it be and why?
I knew this one was coming too, and you're not gonna it's gonna be the same kind of answer. I live the life I'm living now.
Good.
I mean, again, I'm here for a purpose. I believe I am.
Yeah.
Then why should I want to live any other life? You know, could live better life, but
sure,
you know, if that's what I want, then I live it from here on out with who I am rather
perfect
than being somebody else. So
that's still a great answer. We've had other people say it too, and I really like it. And then the bonus question that you don't know about, and I didn't write it down. I just thought of it now. So what message right now would you like to deliver to your kids?
I think probably, I mean, I may have said it already in this, but just go forward and fail. Yeah. You know, it's try things and fail at it, and just, And I use a phrase a lot with my son and probably more with my daughter when she gets a little bit older. But, you know, I've kind of established this mantra of be your best today, be better tomorrow. You know, so don't worry about what happened yesterday. Just today's a new day. Go out, be the best that you can, and use that to be better tomorrow. So that's what I'd want to teach them.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect way to end. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Was fun, and again, I'm so grateful I had Jeff in for that conversation. Loved talking about balancing the nurturing and the more that kick you in the ass energy, just keeping everything in balance to help somebody to really drive them forward. Also love the idea that we discussed about everyone having a lesson to learn. It's something I try to keep in mind in every interaction I have, you know. Even though I'm not perfect and fail to keep that in mind at times, but what it does for me is make me a bit more gentle towards the failures of others and my own failures. At the same time, it doesn't make excuses. The lesson remains there to achieve or to learn. And I think with baby steps, I think we can all continue towards learning, and figuring out these lessons together. Thanks again, Jeff. He mentioned a blog in there, and I will put a link to his blog in the show notes. Okay. Before I share how I'm feeling about this last week, I do want to mention up front that I will be talking about depression and Anthony Bourdain's suicide. If that makes you uncomfortable or sad, maybe skip this part, if you're actually contemplating suicide or just need someone to talk to, please call the National Suicide Prevention Line at 1-800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255. And I should make it clear to everyone listening and to my loved ones that this, what I'm about to read is not a cry for help from me. All right. With that said, just wanted to share that, you know, this last week was a tough one. I'm rarely affected by celebrity death, and that is not for a lack of empathy, but instead I simply didn't have a personal relationship with many of these people. I mean, I don't know them. You know, I don't think we can take on the suffering of the world and all every death. So, and this is, you know, most of them are just a case where I don't know these people. I don't have a connection with them. And yes, suffering does make me sad, but again, I can't let myself be affected by every single individual death. With that said, the last week with Anthony Bourdain taking his own life, it really kind of had me feeling down, which caught me off guard. And I'm not going to sit here and claim that I followed his professional career closely or that I've watched everything he's ever done. It's not the case. I haven't watched a lot of it, but what I have started to realize, and maybe some of it from doing this podcast, is I realized how much I admired the man that he was. I admired how he acknowledged his flaws, how he seemingly took control of his life to correct those flaws, and how he advocated for women, how he was kind of displayed this gentle way of not giving a fuck and was just himself, being a kind and giving and gracious man at the same time. He traveled the globe, shared meals with strangers, embraced the unknown, and helped make people who watched his shows a little less fearful of people from different parts of the world who were living differently. As a man, I realized I had a deep admiration for him, and that he was someone that I looked up to. I also realized that it's quite possible that him and I shared a similar pain. And, you know, traveling the world to see other cultures has been a huge blessing in my life. I've learned more than I can even explain with words. I've eaten incredible food. I've shared laughs with people who don't even speak English. And I didn't speak their language. And I've seen both weird and awe-inspiring sights. But what I also experienced in these travels, and it's something I struggled with for many years, is loneliness. You know, traveling, as incredible as it seems, and it is to experience, can be extremely lonely and mentally taxing. And I'm not saying this is why Anthony Bourdain killed himself. It's not my place to speculate. I don't know. I don't know if it's important for me to speculate or figure it out, but I came across one of his quotes that struck me a bit, and I've heard him intimate much of the same idea in other places. In an interview, he said this: "As you move through this life and through this world, you change things slightly. You leave marks behind, however small. And in return, life and travel leaves marks on you. Most of the time, those marks on your body or on your heart are beautiful. Often, though, they hurt." You know, I always plan my vacations or my holidays or whatever you want to call them, both domestically and internationally, around where I'm going to eat. I truly have always felt that the best way to experience a culture is through its food. And it's also an incredibly effective way to connect with locals. Now, whether or not I picked this up from Anthony Bourdain's early work, I don't know, but I've just always have really bought into that, and it's proven true. And to share this story, to paint this picture of what I'm talking about, on one such vacation, I remember sitting alone eating dinner in Rome. It was a really nice evening, neither hot nor cold, and there weren't many people around. So I felt really comfortable in this setting, and I had researched beforehand where to get the best kind of non-touristy pizza, just so I could get a really true, authentic experience. And I came across a small family restaurant that used local ingredients, and they made their own wine, their own family recipe, and I knew that was my spot. I arrived and was greeted by a person who seemed to be the mother of everyone working there. She smiled warmly and was excited to see me, obviously knowing that I was a foreigner, but she was just super excited to have me there and super excited about the wine and the food, and was eager for me to be there. And again, I felt like I was part of the family. I took a seat outside so I could watch people pass by. I usually always like people watching, even in, you know, whatever I'm doing, because I just find it so fascinating. And phone tucked away in the pocket and just observing, and just wanted to also enjoy the nice evening air. She offered some of her family's estate wine, which I happily accepted. Oh my God, it's some of the best wine I've ever had. It was like $3 or $4 a glass. Obviously had more than one at that point. It was so good. I was just grateful that she offered, you know, some of her family's wine that they had bottled just, you know, not too long before. But, I just sat there and sipped on the wine while I waited for the pizza to arrive. And while sitting there, I couldn't help to think how rad it was that I was sitting in Rome drinking wine on such a nice evening and with no real plans. That was it, just fully in that moment. Then the pizza arrived, and I remember the crust being just beautifully blistered with it. It looked like it just had that nice, perfect amount of crunch, and then it would have an equally nice amount of chewiness just awaiting my senses. The toppings, they were just beautifully spread out and arranged, and all the vegetables and everything looked fresh. It was just a great presentation and really just had me hooked in this moment. And as I cut into the pizza that was so clearly made with care, all of a sudden a man with an accordion starts playing music. I just paused and looked up at him and smiled. The only thing I could think at the time, I guess, was it just all felt a bit cliche, right? Lights, music, wine, pizza. I mean, come on, how fucking cool is that in Rome? And it was with that thought, you know, that how fucking cool is this thought, that I turned to my left and turned to my right and saw no one there with whom to share this moment. And despite all that was around me, I suddenly felt deeply sad and didn't know what to do. And, you know, to kind of ease this discomfort, I quickly pulled out my phone and opened my Facebook Messenger app and connected with Mama D, one of my lovely mother figures who's always been there for me. And she was there quickly responding, and not because I responded with panic. I just wanted to share the moment, which I did. And it was just so nice to even digitally share this moment with her. But the pain subsided a little bit after that. And I share that story with as much detail as I can remember, just to illustrate that no matter how incredible a moment may seem, no matter how amazing one's life may look on the surface, depression, loneliness, or, you know, and everything in between, that it doesn't care. It doesn't care how successful you are. It doesn't care what you're doing. It can strike at any moment. It can seep through the most successful career or family situation. It can still get you. You never know what a person might be going through or what lesson they're trying to learn, but I can bet there's something beneath the surface that we can't see. You know, another story, just in the weeks following my dad's death, we needed to plan a memorial, right? It's just something that obviously people do, and we wanted to do, and wanted to create this celebration out of it. But I didn't even think about it for several days. I didn't want to. The planning, even thinking about planning, even that word felt overwhelming. I just didn't have the energy. I didn't know where to start. And it just, I didn't put any thought to it. And yet again, it was Mama D and her husband, both my dad's best friends, to the rescue. Without asking or consulting, they took charge and started planning. Didn't check in with me. They simply jumped in and helped, which, looking back, is exactly what I needed. Made me feel loved to a degree that brought me tremendous comfort. It was like they were hugging my soul and whispering, "We've got you." It was at a time I didn't really know how to ask for help. But I was lucky enough to have someone who reached out to me with a steady hand. And that is exactly what I would like to encourage others to do. Just reach out to the strong friends, the one who might seem sad, the one who you know is sad, the one who seemingly is living the best life possible. You know, that someone else's dream life, what, you know, what seems like a dream life to you may be their nightmare. So, like, when you reach out, you likely won't have the answers that they need to make them feel 100% happy. It's way too complicated for that, but simply checking in to tell them that you're thinking about them might be enough for that day. Had so many conversations with people while my dad was dying, in which the other person, they just clearly didn't know what to say, which is fine. I get that. It's not an easy thing to talk about. And what are you going to say? There was nothing that somebody could have said that would cure his cancer or made me feel better. But I was never looking for answers. You know, hell, sometimes I just wanted somebody to take me out for a fucking sandwich. Like, that's, I just wanted some food. And it can be that simple. For me, many times it was that simple. And I can only share my experience, so I can't say this is going to work for everybody or this will, in fact, save a life, but it could. It was just that, you know, someone was there to care and someone was thinking about me. And so much, you know, sometimes I'd get a text as simple as just would say, "I love you." And that was enough. And maybe for somebody else, that will be too. So if you're ever just thinking about a loved one or a friend, just let them know you're thinking about them. It could be a lifesaver. I don't know. And just be open, but, you know, also make the first move in helping if you can, because sometimes people who are sad don't know what to do. So thanks for all for listening to that. And with that, I just want to let you know that you're all enough for me. Love you all. And until next time, be present, stay open, much love.
And so there came a point in our evolution when we didn't guide life by distrusting our instincts, and had to think about it, and had to purposely arrange and discipline and push our lives around in accordance with foresight and words and systems of symbols, accountancy, calculation, and so on. And then we worry. Once you start thinking about things, you worry as to whether you've thought enough. Me.